This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 508 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. And joining me first is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, Max. Guess where we are?
We're not at home. We're in this big hangar area, aren't we, David?
Yeah, a little different than we've normally been, but I'm staring at the Enola Gay, a P-61, a Shinden. Basically, I'm home. We're here at the National Air and Space Museum, Woodvarahazy Center, for Innovations in Flight 18.
That's right, 2018. Also joining us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Hi, David. Looking forward to another wonderful event here at Woodvarahazy.
Yeah, it's good you could make it. Came all the way from California.
And believe it or not, I had a fantastic experience on United.
You did? Well, we're going to have to talk about that.
Yep.
All right. But first, let me introduce our main man, Micah, who's also traveled down from Maine to Northern Virginia here to join us. Hi, Micah.
Thank you so much for bringing me along. Good to see you, Max. Wonderful to see you, David. Brian, I'm so glad you had a good flight on United because you know United is the sponsor of Innovations in Flight 2018.
That's right. And they usually have an aircraft outside. Do they? Have you been outside, Brian?
Yeah, they have a 777.
A 777. Very nice. Well, this is an annual event. And as David mentioned, it's the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at the Woodvarahazy Center, just outside Dulles Airport, adjacent to Dulles Airport, I guess you would say. And they do a couple of things. One is they have, well, I guess you could call us exhibitors. Ourselves and a number of other folks here inside the museum, and we'll talk about some of those things coming up. But they also have a fly-in, basically, where airplanes come in from Dulles and sort of taxi over to the Woodvarahazy Center here. And as you mentioned, we have United has a 777 outside. David, you've been outside, haven't you?
We've got a really impressive display this year. We have an albatross, a Grumman albatross. We've got McGuire has sent their heavies. They have a C-17 and a KC-10 out on the line. Hmm. NASA has sent one of their NT-38Cs. And we also have the myriad of Piper, Cessnas, Cherokees, as well as some other Warbirds, there's a Mustang for once out on the line. So it's a really good mix. And the crown, I guess, would be the 777 from United that the line was already stretching around the building to get in.
And, you know, we also have some good friends that flew in that we hope to talk to later. We've got dispatcher Mike Carrells with his Beechcraft Musketeer who flew up from Atlanta yesterday. By his side as his co-pilot was none other than Captain Jeff Nielsen, that airline pilot guy. And also our good friend Hillel Glazier flew in from pretty much around the corner in his Piper. Which Piper does he have? Is it a Cherokee?
I think so. We'll have to ask him.
But, yeah, and hopefully we'll be talking to them about their long and short flights. And also we've got some other guests that we think are coming up, including Captain Rick Bell, who just transferred from the C-130 to the C-17. And he just flew into Andrews and bringing the whole evac crew with him. So could be a lot of fun.
And there's more. We've got some other friends here. We have Drone Mama is here.
I think we have an accountant from a medium-sized Midwestern airport that's going to be visiting with us.
Yes. All right. So we've actually met a couple of listeners in just the few minutes that the event has been open. It runs from 10 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we'll be here all day. We've got a table set up. And we'll be speaking with a number of guests and friends and just people who are here for the event.
And there's something else we need to say very quickly that's very, very important because this is episode number
508.
But last Sunday, a week ago, tomorrow, actually was your Airplane Geeks decade of Airplane Geeks.
First episode, June 10th, 2008. None of us, I think, ever thought that this would stretch on over 10 years so far. Not the least of which probably Drone Mama had no idea that she would be putting up with this for 10 years, as well as the other spouses and significant others from the hosts here. Brian, you haven't been here the whole 10 years, but it's still been a while.
No, yeah, about five for me. I think it'd be really interesting listening or having our listeners write in or send auto recording people that have been with us for all those 10 years and just get their impression of what the show was like, how it's changed, what they like, what they don't like. I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to hear from our longtime listeners.
That's one thing we always love is hearing from you all listening, and we do get lots of feedback. As always, you can send us emails to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We love recorded messages especially because, well, after all, we are an audio podcast, and we love getting those kinds of messages and stories and things like that. Another way you can communicate with us is through our Slack listener team. This has become, over the last couple of years, a really great community, a place where just us airplane geeks can hang out, get together. We have one for airplane geeks. Also, Airline Pilot Guy has a Slack team.
Yes, and if you want to get in touch with them, and we'll be talking with the Airline Pilot Guy, but Hillel runs a Slack team, so if you get in touch with Hillel, he'll be able to add you to the Slack team list. If it's okay, you know, last week I sent in a brief message to you guys, and it may have been a bit more cryptic than I meant for it to be. But this message was
just a little.
The message was because it was at last, very last minute. Max didn't even know what it said until he played it. But the message was to a listener, Jason, who had written in the episode before, who was having some difficulties with the Civil Air Patrol and trying to get his flight lessons. And I suggested that Brian re-record a wonderful story that he wrote, how we met. That was on episode 269. Now, Brian may or may not re-record that, but the reason I suggested that is because that story includes Brian's experience with the Civil Air Patrol and how he persevered through it. And I just thought it might help our listener, Jason, to understand that he's not alone in these scenarios. And I think it would be a great thing if he would give that a listen, because that was a good part of that story.
We even had a comment from someone who came by, Mike, one of our listeners, and he actually commented about the CAP stories and feedback we've had from some of you recently, and how it's always exciting to hear how this podcast, in some small way, has influenced a number of people in great ways, in positive ways, when it comes to, you know, expanding their enthusiasm for aviation.
Yeah, and in addition to that, we've had the segments that listener Nikki has provided us, and I got an email from her just the other day where she actually finished up her training. So there are two more segments that she's submitted, so we'll get them on air soon. But she is now a private pilot, and that's a direct result of the show and the feedback that we provide, or encouragement that we provided to her. So congratulations to listener Nikki.
That's fantastic. Yeah, Nikki, great work. Another pilot joins the crew, so we're really excited about that. All right, well, we're going to speak with a number of people during the course of the day, and we'll start bringing those to you right now.
Well, being the dork that I am, I can't not interview someone in a blue flight suit, because blue means NASA. And we've got Adam Klein here from the Johnson Space Center in Texas. We also have a guest commentator with us who has flown in T-38s also and flies a podcast weekly too. Captain Jeff, welcome aboard.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Adam, we were talking as we came from the airplane that you brought, which is an NT-38. As we were talking about my favorite aspect of NASA, which is the first A instead of the S. So tell me a little bit about the aeronautics and what you do for NASA.
Yeah, so I'm a research pilot with NASA. My primary mission is to fly the T-38. And as a T-38 research pilot, I train astronauts. So it's a pretty cool job. Not a whole lot of people get to say, I actually get to train astronauts. Some people may say, hey, I work for things to provide astronauts. I actually get to get in the same aircraft and help train the astronauts. And we go out and execute missions together on a regular basis. So it's a lot of fun. We just got done finishing the initial training for this new astronaut candidate class. And so we broke them up into two halves. We took the pilot astronauts first, and most of them have, you know, a lot of aviation experience. Some have T-38 experience, and we were just kind of translating to what their aviation background is to now how do we want you to operate the T-38 for NASA. But then the second half of the class, that was actually the more interesting and fun part of the class because they were the non-pilots of the class. So they were going to be researchers or scientists, doctors, educators, all the ones that don't have an operational aviation background experience. We train them on how to fly the T-38 and how to operate as a crew member. So that's my primary job is a T-38 instructor pilot, but I also do a maintenance check flight pilot. We do a NASA test pilot as we're doing new changes of hardware and software for the T-38. We do the test pilots, but also research projects where we go and test different research missions all around and other platforms we have. So we have research platforms. And then my favorite job, I like to say, is I'm an astronaut Uber driver, because when an astronaut needs to go to a place, instead of putting them in the back of a Southwest flight, we'll say, hey, jump in the T-38 and we'll get training value as we go and get you to where you need to go.
I like that, training value. Good excuse. Can I get some training value in the backseat of a T-38? So besides training, what's it like training astronauts? Are they comfortable with the T-38? Is there a lot of nerves for like mission specialists who aren't really familiar with flying airplanes?
Yeah, we do put them through Pensacola first before we get them out of that. So they get some baseline level of aviation experience in a T-6 trainer. So by the time they get to us, a lot of the initial jitters are kind of out. So they have some baseline. But the NASA does an incredible job of selecting people that are not only incredibly skilled and intelligent, but also adaptable. So all of the candidates that we have that just came through, they adapted very quickly and rapidly to what we needed them to do in the T-38 environment. So they're just sponges. They just can't wait to learn the T-38 and how to succeed in this platform towards spaceflight readiness.
So tell me a little bit about your career. Where did you start? How did you get to fly a blue jumpsuit?
Yeah. I've always wanted to work for NASA ever since I was a little kid. You know, growing up, I went to air shows and loved that kind of stuff. And so I went to college at The Ohio State University, studied engineering there. And then after, I did ROTC while I was in college and did Navy ROTC. From there, went to Navy Flight School and became a Hornet pilot. So I flew the Legacy F-18s, did some operational tour with the Navy in Japan. And then came back to, I came to Patuxent River to go to the Navy's test pilot school, where I was a test pilot and then did some test flying at Patuxent River. Then went back to the fleet, again to Japan, but flying Super Hornets this time. And then after that, came back to Patuxent River to the test pilot school. So I either like to be in Japan or Pax River. I kind of bounce back and forth there all the time.
Yeah, it seems like you like being in school a lot.
I do like being in school. Well, if you want to work for NASA, you better be comfortable going to school a lot. And then after my last tour at Patuxent River as an instructor at the test pilot school, I found out about this job that was opening up at NASA Johnson Space Center, and to get the opportunity to not only work for NASA, but fly for NASA. Like, what, you're going to pay me? And you're going to pay me to fly, and you're going to pay me to fly and train astronauts? Sign me up. So I jumped on that, and I've been with NASA for about a year and a half.
So your test pilot school training, how has that helped you with NASA?
So test pilot school training is great because it teaches you how to be a fantastic observer and communicator and also evaluate risk. One of the most important things about running a test program is to do risk assessment. Where are the hazards, and how do we need to mitigate against those hazards? How do we develop a program that is going to be successful, that is actually going to meet our mission objectives, but still maintain the safety of the crew and of the vehicle, which potentially could be a one-off type of a prototype vehicle. And so looking at that perspective of you have one-of-a-kind assets that you're having to execute a mission with in the test environment, well, now I'm flying with high-value assets. There's a lot of money and effort put into training and making an astronaut. So I have to, you know, every flight I do is, you know, takes that same kind of level of criticality of I have a very critical asset. You know, this aircraft and these people that are flying it are national assets. And so I need to be extraordinarily cautious, yet still achieve the mission objective. And kind of the test of flying and the test mentality, I think, translates very well to that.
Going back to the T-38.
Yes.
My experience with it was undergraduate pilot training. So, and what we used that airplane for was an introduction to high performance formation flying, in addition to aerobatic flying, that kind of thing, and then also some navigation and instrument training. I'm trying to imagine in my head, you're talking about using the T-38 as a training opportunity. Do you do more than just, you know, go from A to B and cruise altitude, and, or do you actually go out to areas and do some of the stuff that we did in pilot training?
Yeah, we do the whole kind of gamut. So we will do basic navigation training. We'll do instruments. We do dynamic maneuvering, tactical maneuvering. We'll do multiplane formation. So we are trying to do as much as kind of very similar to the Air Force. But what we really use the T-38 for is we're going to take, right now, the majority of our astronauts are do not have an aviation background. So it is, they don't have that operational experience per se. Some of them do not. So if we put them in an environment where, say, you've got limited resources, the T-38 start takes off, and you're pretty much at minimum fuel, right? There's just very little fuel. You have oxygen that you have to, you know, manage. You have all these consumables you have to manage. You have to function together as a crew. Crew resource management. You have to make time-critical decision-making. You have to continually assess dynamic situations. What's the weather doing? What's air traffic control trying to paint us into a corner? I need to be able to effectively communicate not only with my crew members, but down to ground control. There's an analogy there, right? Operating, communicating with the crew members on the space vehicle, communicating with the crew members in mission control. So there's a lot of analogs to high-performance jet flying to actually executing a spaceflight mission. I just got to fly with Thursday. Got to fly with Peggy Whitson on her final flight, her Finney flight. So pretty amazing experience. You know, she has just such an incredible spaceflight career and career with NASA. And as I was coming back, I had to pick her brain. I say, all right, you've been with NASA for so many years. You've done so much with NASA. What was your most valuable training to prepare you for spaceflight? And she said, without a doubt, hands down, T-38. And she said, in T-38 training, she had one of her Soyuz reentries was a malfunction, and they had a ballistic reentry. And they were at over 5 Gs, I think, for more than 8 minutes, and they got up to 8.5 Gs sustained. And they're having to go through and execute emergency procedures. And so imagine, you know, in an uncomfortable environment, wearing all your flight gear, having to run through checklists, coordinate with your other crew members. It's like nothing, no experience other than flying in the T-38 was able to prepare her successfully to have for that situation for a ballistic reentry. So T-38 does provide extraordinary training value for our astronauts.
What aircraft do you enjoy flying the most, or what do you look forward to flying the most?
That's a great question, because it depends on what do I want to do. Do I want to go light my hair on fire and bend a jet around? Then the F-18, that's one of my favorite airplanes to do it. Some of just the most satisfying flying I'll ever do is is in a glider. It's just so pure, and soaring and gliding is great. So I'm one of these strange individuals where I either like to have two engines or no engines. That's kind of the flying. I was like, give me a T-38 or an F-18 or just take all my engines away from me and then fly in a glider.
Do you do the glider in a personal level, or does NASA actually have a program where you actually fly gliders?
So NASA does not have, well, they kind of do, and I'll get to that. I flew gliders with the Navy test pilot school because we would have a Schweitzer 232 that we would have towed behind a U-6 a Beaver, and so we would do a glider training to teach high lift over drag lateral directional flying qualities for the test pilot school. Having that qualification, one of the other really nice things about flying with NASA is that you generally don't just fly one airplane. So I fly the T-38, I fly a Gulfstream 3, and I also fly the WB-57. And so the WB-57, that may be kind of a head scratcher. Most of the people on the podcast are probably going.
No, it's not.
Well, some people know.
But for some people.
For some people. Other some people know
are,
exactly
some people
what
are
that
salivating
is.
The fact that we're going to talk about WB-57s.
So for WB-57, I just finished my initial qualification on the WB-57. And the single aircraft that prepared me best for that very, very unique airframe was not anything else I'd flown. No, you know, glider, no, you know, high performance aircraft. It was the gliders. Because, and in the landing pattern coming down for in, you're effectively all the way back at idle. And the only difference is the WB-57 from that to a normal glider is you have go around capability. If you, the landing's not looking good, you can go around. But flying that operationally is like very much flying a glider. You got the gear down, you got the spoilers out. At some point, you're like, I don't have any more high lift drag, high drag devices. And so, time to slip and kind of put a slip in, see if I can, you know, either lose speed or lose altitude or a combination of both. So flying gliders was a great lead in trainer for the WB-57.
Really cool.
That's it. Well, so that is the Canberra before we did the wing modification. So our WB-57s have a 122-foot, 5-inch wingspan. When fully fueled, has an 18-inch ground clearance. So we have a taxi speed of 5 knots. You go more than 5 knots, you're scraping a wingtip. And there are wood strips on the bottom of the wingtips that are sanded and painted. And so part of your pre-flight item is everyone go, okay, it's smooth when I took off, and it's smooth when I landed. So I didn't scrape a wingtip, but that's always, you know, something we're trying to avoid is scraping a wingtip on there. So we have at landing, takeoff and landing on the WB, 3.5 degrees of angle of bank. That's our limit. Anything if we exceed 3.5 degrees, we're going to scrape a wingtip. So it's very tight tolerance.
So high crosswind takeoffs and landings probably not
no,
something you do.
15 knots is the dash one limit for how we can do for a crosswind performance.
So then if you scrape it, is there any sort of penalty that you have to do or just lots of hazing?
Lots of hazing. And then, you know, the maintenance guys, they got to buff it out. So you probably go there and like, all right, I'll help you sand this out. I'm paying it. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's mostly shame.
It's mostly shame. Well, so back in my F-18 days, was flying off the west coast of Australia and just crazy swells. I mean, 30-foot swells, and I'm seeing the screws coming out of the water. And so I had a 6.5G landing, 6.5 vertical G landing. And it was one of those, like, normally when you land, there's a flight deck chief, and he's asking you, is your airplane up or is your airplane down? If your airplane's up, they send you to the bow. If your airplane's down, they're going to send you aft. That's where all the birds are going to go eventually down to the hangar bay to get their maintenance work. I landed. I looked over the maintenance chief. The maintenance chief wasn't even looking at me. He was just already waving to the back. He's like, I already know where this airplane's going. So
I thought they'd just dump it off the side.
Yeah. No. But so that they had to replace both main mounts. And so I felt bad for our airframers. So, you know, jacking the airplane up is one of the, you know, painful evolutions to do. And it's hot. And so I'm like, all right, I will do that. So I jacked my own airplane up after I cracked the main struts on those. But to its credit, the F-18's landing gear didn't collapse. They just, you know, had some cracks that had to be replaced. But it's a F-18 was a very incredible, very capable airframe.
Well, Adam, thank you for your service in the Navy. Thank you for your service in NASA. And thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You know, the best things usually come out when we stop recording. But Adam was nice enough to impart this story for us. You had a bit of a lunar mission, I would say.
Yes.
Or a solar mission.
Yeah.
You want to talk about it?
So my NASA had sent me up to Alaska to do a research mission studying permafrost. And we were using NASA's Gulfstream 3. And as we were scheduled to return, we just happened to realize, hey, we're going to be flying on the day of the total solar eclipse. And NASA has a lot of aircraft that were dedicated to looking at the solar eclipse. So there was a lot of coordination that NASA had done ahead of time with air traffic control. But my co-pilot and I were like, hey, I think we're going to actually be able to fly right through the heart of the eclipse on our way down to California. And so we planned it out, we made it work, and we got right in there in the heart, and we got to sit there right in the heart of the eclipse, and it was amazing. But we wanted to stay and maneuver and increase our time. And it's amazing if you look at the density of traffic that everyone was just trying to coordinate with ATC to get in to see the solar eclipse from their airplane. And you could just hear this air traffic controller getting more and more frustrated with, hey, request, request, request. Finally, this controller just lost it and said, if your call sign does not start with the word NASA, your request is denied. The only people that are getting special handling right now are NASA aircraft, so stop asking. And so we got to spend some extra time in the total solar eclipse, so it was great.
So you spent an extra second just really enunciating the NASA at the beginning of your call sign, right?
The only unfortunate thing is that I was the junior pilot at the time, and so I'm sitting right seat, and the view of the eclipse was out the left seat, and so I'm looking at my pilot, and he's just got this, oh my gosh, that is incredible. That's amazing. And I'm sitting there right like, yeah, I bet. Probably. I don't know. I can't see anything. I'm sitting in the right seat. So he took some pictures for me. He was nice enough to get some pictures.
Oh, so you didn't make him do a 360 for you?
No. But it was a really awesome experience. And I've got a great snapshot of all of the traffic, the ATC printout at that time of our airplane going right through the heart of the eclipse and all these other airplanes just right on the periphery trying to get in. And we were the only one that had just the perfect straight shot right through. So, yeah, sometimes it is good to work for NASA.
Great airplane geek story. Again, Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, there's a number of organizations, groups, and people who are exhibiting inside the museum, and one of them is the Society of Women Engineers, and we have one of the volunteers from that group, Catherine, is here to talk with us. Catherine, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Catherine, tell our listeners a little bit about the Society of Women Engineers and what the purpose of the organization is, what it tries to accomplish.
Sure. So Society of Women Engineers, or SWE for short, as we like to call it, is all about promoting women in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM. And in addition to promoting women pursuing careers in STEM, we really try to help encourage young girls to pursue those careers as well. So we're here at the museum trying to have people get interested in those STEM careers today.
And so you have a table set up. You're right along next to the space shuttle, aren't you?
Yep. It's a good location.
It is a great location. And tell us a little bit about the kinds of people you're trying to reach today.
Yeah, so it's a lot of whoever drops by, but primarily we really try to reach out to young girls because we're trying to get them interested in science and math and engineering now.
Yes.
And have them continue their interest going through school all the way through college. But we welcome anybody that wants to stop by, especially those maybe women who used to be in engineering and took a step away and are interested in getting back into the engineering field. We welcome them back with open arms, and we're here to help them get back into that career. But again, it's primarily young girls that we're trying to reach out to.
And you're part of a local chapter or local organization?
Yeah. Yeah. So Society of Women Engineers is global, but we primarily are in the United States. So we have chapters all across the country. The local chapter, the local section is called Baltimore, Washington section. And so the members volunteering here today are part of that section.
And about how many members are there?
Total in SWE, we have thousands, tens of thousands. The local chapter itself is probably around 800 to 1,000.
Wow, that's good size.
Yeah.
Now, being an old guy, I come from a time when trying to recruit women into engineering was a really, really difficult thing. And that I see that changing, and it's wonderful to see that change, but how is that working for you? Is it easier? How do you do the recruitment, and what's changed about it with the Society for Women Engineers?
Well, I think that's actually a really interesting question. I think one of the biggest things that has changed is we try not to say, oh, you're good at science and math, you'll be a good engineer. Now we try to focus it more on you want to solve problems. You want to help people, right? Because most young girls they want to be a doctor, they want to be a nurse, they want to do something to help somebody. And so they never really think that engineering can do that. And so we've tried to kind of change the way that we talk to young girls, saying, you want to help people, you want to be a doctor. Well, biomedical engineering can get you there, right? Become an engineer, then you have an engineering background on which to fall. Should you not go to med school, should something change, right? So I think that's probably the biggest change has been how we talk to young girls, specifically focusing on, do you want to make a difference? Be an engineer.
Wow. I like that a lot.
Yeah,
I like that.
Cool.
Now, how about you personally? Are you an engineer?
I am. I'm an aerospace engineer.
Ah, tell us a little bit about, your education.
So I went through long 9 years of college, not because it took me that long to get my bachelor's, but because I ended up getting a PhD. So I have a PhD in aerospace engineering. I am a rocket scientist. So my mom,
nice.
My mom can no longer say that's not rocket science. She has to say like, oh, it's not brain surgery, which is also very difficult. But I went to college for a long time. I'm very happy with the degree that I chose. Ever since I was little, I wanted to be an astronaut. And so that's what got me into aerospace. Then various things happened. Then I wanted to be a flight director. And then I tried that and I didn't like it as much. So long story short, I ended up out here in the DC area and very happy. Love aerospace. And I have always been fascinated by space. So just love it.
So you said you're kind of a rocket scientist. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you're doing now?
Yeah, it's a lot more about solving problems, right? It's a lot more about figuring out what the right way to solve the problem is. So I do a lot more systems engineering, looking at the big picture, trying to figure out what we're missing and how to fill that gap, how to put those puzzle pieces together. And so it's a lot of the engineering process. It's a lot of figuring out what the problem is, how we can solve it, trying it, and if it doesn't work, trying something else, right?
Can you talk about any specific project that you've worked on or a piece of equipment that you've helped build, design, test, break?
So in graduate school, I led my small satellite lab. So that is very much an engineering process in a nutshell, right? Because my lab specifically designed, built, and flew 3U CubeSats. And so it's everybody in our lab was doing all of it, right? We were designing the algorithms for the reaction wheels. We were testing the algorithms to see how they worked. We were figuring out what the environmental test procedures needed to be and working with. We were working with the Air Force Research Lab to actually do the environmental testing. So it was very much everybody worked together to figure out what had to happen. And then you get to see it, like you actually get to have it in your hands, right? And build it yourself. And then it gets put on a rocket and gets flown up into space. And so somewhere in space, my name is floating around on a little PCB board, right?
Amazing.
And that's really cool.
Yeah, that is so cool.
Yeah, maybe say a little bit about CubeSats for our listeners that
sure.
may not be familiar with the concept.
Yeah, so a CubeSat is basically the size of a loaf of bread is the comparison I use, specifically 3 units. So each unit is a 10-centimeter cube. So when you put 3 of them together, it's about the size of a loaf of bread, and that's the size of spacecraft we were working on. There are varieties, right? You can go bigger or smaller than that. Now, some small satellites are now called like femtosatellites, so they're the size of your fingernail, which is crazy. And then there are bigger satellites too, like about the size of a car tire. So small satellites can be really anything. But we primarily worked on those CubeSats.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, Catherine, tell our listeners where they can learn more about the Society of Women Engineers.
Yeah, so SWE, you can Google us. We have Twitter at SWE Talk is the handle. Facebook is Society Women Engineers, plain and simple. And then societywomenengineers.org for the actual website. And we would love to have you stop by the booth today if you're listening or find us online and talk to us later.
All right. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you so much for stopping by to SWE Talk our listeners.
Thank you.
That's pretty good, Micah.
Yeah. Well, outside
when you walk outside, right by the place of honor, right by the hangar entrance, is a beautiful blue Grumman albatross amphibian, an HU-16C. And with it is we have the pilot, J.B. Hollier, who is about to tell us a little bit about Pegasus and what Pegasus is going to do in 2019. J.B., welcome to the Airplane Geeks.
Thanks. Great to be here. I appreciate you guys calling me in.
So tell us a little bit about why you brought the Albatross here for Innovations in Flight.
Okay. I'm part of a 501c3 nonprofit called seaplanecrossings.org, and the website's out there for those who are interested. And we're chartered to spend time with children of all ages, including our age, and try to teach and bring out the history, the very, very rich history of seaplane aviation in particular, aviation in general, but principally seaplane aviation. And I give a little talk out plane side that I think you had an opportunity to hear. And I've been asked to kind of come in and chat a little bit about that. So most people in America think that Charles Lindbergh was the first guy to cross the Atlantic. And the truth of the story is that he was the first guy to solo across the Atlantic. The first aircraft across the Atlantic was a Navy airplane. It was commissioned as a Navy warship. The USS, the Navy bought four of them towards the end of World War I, the USS NC-1, NC-2, NC-3, and NC-4, and they were seaplanes. They were ships that just happened to fly. The Navy hadn't figured out yet how to buy an airplane because they were pretty new, and they could get Congress to commission ships, so they bought four ships that just happened to have wings and flew. So the first of them was delivered at the end of 1918, the remaining three in early 1919. They were stationed at NAS Rockaway, New York, and in early January of 1919, their hangar burned down and burned up NC-2. So NC-1, 3, and 4 were remaining. They were still doing flight tests on them. And in May of 1919, they left New York City to try to be the first aircraft ever to cross the Atlantic Ocean. They took off in two-minute intervals out of New York Harbor, NAS Rockaway Beach. They went from New York to Boston to Halifax to a little tiny place called Trepassey Bay in Newfoundland, and then on to the Azores, which was a 1,200-mile leg from Newfoundland to the Azores. Now, these airplanes really just had a wet compass to navigate by. They had removed most of the stuff out of the aircraft, all the batteries, all the everything except gasoline to try to make that that 1,200-mile leg. They flew 80 miles an hour, so it was a 15-hour crossing. It was an all-night crossing. In order to help them out, the U.S. Navy hooked them up with a warship. Every 50 miles, they parked a warship across the Atlantic and shone big spotlights up into the sky and shot starburst flares and things like that. 6 hours into the flight, the airplanes went over the top of an overcast and could not get below it. And they flew the entire night just about with no contact with their surface combatants. So as daylight came on the other end, now they still hadn't invented sextants that you could fly at 80 miles an hour and take a fix. So they needed to land on the water and take a fix to see where they were. So one by one, they made their descents. NC-1 landed. They found a break in the overcast, went circling through the overcast, landed on the water. And when they landed, they broke the tail off the aircraft. That airplane sank. The crew was rescued by one of the warships. NC-3 finds a break in the overcast, and she slowly descends down and lands and breaks the tail off the aircraft. But they were able to get a fix on where they were, 150, 200 miles to the southwest of the Azores. So they disassembled their airplane, turned it into a boat, and sailed for 3 days, bringing the airplane by themselves. They brought that aircraft slash boat into the Azores. NC-4, when she found a break in the overcast, she looked down, and there was land. And it was the Azores. So she circled down, landed right where she belonged. She went on to refuel that aircraft, stepped the next leg into Lisbon, Portugal, and finally into Portsmouth, England, becoming the first aircraft to cross the Atlantic Ocean. So we formed a 501c3 nonprofit, seaplanecrossings.org, with a charter, as I mentioned, of trying to teach this rich history to the children of the world. We've teamed up with the Forrest Tech Center, James Forrest Tech Center in St. Mary's County, Maryland. And we're putting together a team, and we're going to recreate that first crossing of the Atlantic in May of 1919. We've got some sponsorship. In fact, the Air and Space Museum has been terrific to us. They don't actually sponsor, but they've opened up their archives to us. We've spent quite a bit of time in the Udvar-Hazy Center going through all their records on the NC-4, which is actually belongs to the Air and Space Museum. It's on display down at the National Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola. But that airplane still exists, and you can go down and touch the metal, you know, as it were. But it belongs to Udvar-Hazy here at the Air and Space. And so we were very proud to come here and represent Seaplane Aviation as the only airplane out there on that airfield right now here at the Udvar-Hazy Center that can land on the water more than once.
Yeah.
So we'd love for you to go to the website. We'd love you to donate or have the opportunity to watch. We're going to try and do live broadcasts across the entire transit. The information technology group at the James Forrest Tech Center is helping us out with that. We've got video. We'll have a teacher probably on board, and we're going to do live classroom sessions in the month of May as we do that crossing. So it should be a lot of fun to watch. We'd love for you, anybody out there, to be part of that.
JB, how did you come personally to be involved in this project?
So I fell in love with the Albatross. I was a naval aviator, and went through test pilot school back in 1985 and had an opportunity to fly seaplanes, and flew an Albatross and fell in love with the airplane. And I finally got to a position in life where I could afford to go play with an airplane like that. So I spent the entire year of 1914 and halfway through 2015, looking at just about every Albatross that was for sale in America, and finally picked her out of the bunch and bought it the end of 2015. And we spent 6-8 months trying to get her back airborne and flying, and it's a bit of a labor of love. But I and a couple of the other guys that were Albatross people meet every November on Lake Conroe on Veterans Day weekend and fly Albatrosses. And so we came up with the idea about a year and a half ago, why don't we do something fun with aviation and seaplane aviation in particular? So we founded it. I'm actually the president of that nonprofit, that 501c3, and so we founded that just to do these fun things with airplanes and try to teach kids about, before there were runways, how did you get around? How did you fly from place to place when there was no runway? We worked with a young man named Dirk Braun, a terrific kid, cinematographer, and he's developed a complete series on seaplane aviation. And you can go to flyingboatfilm.com, which is his website, and he's put together quite a documentary. He's got a 3 or 4 minute teaser on there of what was life like before there was a runway, and it's all about seaplane aviation. It's a terrific documentary, and he's got a lot of footage, including a little bit of Pegasus, I might add. So,
The Albatross, the Grumman Albatross, came out about late 40s.
Correct.
How many are left flying right now?
Great question. And you're right. The first of them was produced in 49, so it's late 40s technology. The last of them, about 57. They made 465 of them. Pegasus is about number 406, give or take, built in 55, towards the end of the model run. There's probably a dozen flying right now that fly quite a bit. There's another dozen, maybe 15, that can but don't for whatever reason. They don't fly them very much. And the rest of them are all museum pieces and living on popsicle sticks outside of, airports and places like that. They two versions, basically three if you count the G-111, but they had a long wing and a short wing. The long wing aircraft, when they put the splice in the wing, created quite a fatigue problem with the aircraft. So Grumman fixed it by putting steel straps on the spar caps, which created a heck of a corrosion problem, you know, having steel on top of the 7075 T6, right? So all of those long wing aircraft have some, if they've done a good job of keeping the corrosion off the aircraft, and quite a number of them have, quite a number of them are beautiful airplanes, but they all run up against the fatigue life, which nominally is about 10,000 hours. The Air Force flew the airplanes almost to their end game. So most of the long wingers don't have a lot of life left on them. The short wingers don't have that problem. They're good forever.
What was the reason for extending the wing?
Better flying qualities, better single engine characteristics, better range. They added a couple of hundred miles of range by adding that weight to the aircraft. So they fly very nicely. Actually, both of the aircraft fly very nicely, long wing and short wing.
The Albatross, I mean, it just amazes me that you're flying an aircraft with a bilge, because there just aren't a lot of them out there. Right. And you're amphibious. As a pilot, how are you thinking when you're flying, or rather landing on a runway versus landing in the water? Because with the same aircraft, because not all aircraft do that.
Right. It's like landing on floats and with wheels under the floats or something. Yeah. So what I found is that as you develop a verbal litany that you use, right, and it starts out with, this is a shore landing, give me the shore landing checklist, or this is a water landing, give me the water landing checklist. And we have, when you get to landing gear, you know, whether the gear is up or gear is down, depending on where you are, you have to say your litany. And there's two people in the cockpit, and it involves looking out the window to see if your landing gear is up or down. There's a great little window on the floor in the cockpit where you can actually look into the nose wheel compartment, and you're looking for a light on in that compartment if the gear is down, and no light in the compartment if the gear is up. So there's, you know, it's a, you do that because if you ever try to touch down on the water with the gear, you're going to be an unhappy fellow, you know, so.
All right. Well, JB, it sounds like a wonderful project, and this is in 2019. What's
May of 2019, and you can go to the website, www.seaplanecrossings.org, and we've actually got pictures of NC4. This past fall, we had a great time with Pegasus. We did three hurricane relief flights down to St. Thomas, flying cargo out of Fort Pierce, Florida. We took about 13,000 pounds of cargo down in three events, put 82 hours on the aircraft in 11 days. You know, she really is a workhorse, done really, really well. So we're pretty proud of her.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you, JB.
Yep. Appreciate your time.
One of the great things about this event is that it's called a family day, an aviation display. And there are people here of all ages. We've seen old folks. We've seen young folks. And we have one of the younger folks here today. Your name is Jack. And where are you from, Jack?
I'm from Herndon, Virginia.
Herndon, Virginia. So you're pretty close to this museum. Have you been to this museum in the past?
Yes, many times.
Many times. And what do you like about this museum?
I just like all the plane displays and just how they have so many awesome and amazing exhibits. I especially love today because I got to go inside aircrafts and everything. And there's also many simulators here. That's fun.
So you've been here many, many times. So mm-hmm. When you come in here, each time you come, where's the first place you like to go?
Well, the first place I'd like to go, technically the first place I go is I go down the ramp, and the first place that I would like to go would most likely be either the IMAX theater or the simulators, just saying. But I haven't really ever gone there first, so. Actually, I haven't even gone to the IMAX theater.
You've never been to the IMAX theater?
No.
Neither have I. We sit here at this table every time. Every year we do this, and I've never been to the theater.
And the other place I've never been. Now, have you been up? There's a tower where you can listen and watch the airplanes.
I've been up there. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you like watching the airplanes land?
It's sometimes it's interesting, but sometimes it's just kind of boring. It's like, oh, I see a pigeon. Yay. I am.
That's okay, because, you know, pigeons aren't quite aircraft, and you're coming here for the airplanes, right, Jack?
Yeah.
So, Jack, do you build model airplanes or anything like that?
No, I don't do that stuff.
Do you think you might like to be a pilot and fly someday?
Being a pilot seems a bit too dangerous.
Yeah?
If I were to be a pilot, I'd be a commercial pilot.
A commercial pilot?
No, I mean not the pilots in commercials, the pilot flying commercial planes.
Ah, I see.
So you have to join the Navy or the Air Force.
So you're 10 years old now. Do you remember how or when you first started loving airplanes?
Technically, airplanes were never my first love.
No?
But I do like airplanes. I have been on airplanes a lot. I have been across the world many times.
Oh, you've done a lot of flying.
Yes.
Yes?
My dad's a diplomat, and we usually go overseas and visit countries. The airplanes, I like riding airplanes. I don't like flying airplanes.
How about the food? Do you like the food?
It depends on, like, I don't know. Airplane food isn't bad.
So, Jack, you have a trip coming up.
Yeah.
So are you looking forward to flying again?
Flying's pretty fun. I like it. I like, one thing that I like about flying is liftoff and the landing, because I like liftoff because I like to see, I like to look out the window and see the plane rolling, and then just like all of a sudden watch it gain ground, and then just like look as like the ground is just getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And then I'm just in the clouds.
It's a great feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you're flying and you're going across the ocean, now are you looking out the window, or are you usually in your iPad or screen?
Well, depends on the time. If it's like takeoff or landing or like sometime really close to it, then I'm most likely going to be looking at the window. If it's like right in the middle of the flight, like let's say we're just cruising on the Atlantic, I'm just on my phone because it's going to be a very long flight. So
sure.
I can't just look out the window for like 17 hours straight.
Jack, that's great. Thank you so much for stopping by and visiting with us. And if you want to listen to us, this should be on Wednesday. You go to airplanegeeks.com and we'll give you a little button so you can remember.
All right.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Andy Schwartzman. He is a A320 captain for United.
Yeah, my favorite airline. Yay.
We just had Andy, one of the things we do each week is, or we try to do each week, is have a positive airline story of the week. And Brian flew in on United, and he had a fantastic experience.
That's what he was just telling me about. All the stars were aligned.
yes. So how long have you been flying?
I've been with United 20 years.
20 years.
Yes.
And so what did you start with?
I'm a civilian trained pilot, so I flight instructed for Embry-Riddle for a few years after I graduated, and the typical civilian route, instructing to maybe a charter job, which is what I did to build up some multi-engine time. Flew for a charter company for another year, and then I got picked up by Atlantic Southeast Airlines, ASA, and I flew for them for a few years until I got hired by United. So it's your typical civilian pay your dues route.
Any idea what the balance is in terms of airline pilots? How many come up through the military? How many through?
Right now, I want to say the balance is very heavily favored towards civilian. And I think if you did some research, you'll find out the military is actually trying to retain their pilots. They're actually, I think the Air Force is on the short side of pilots. A lot of pilots retiring now in the airline industry, so that's putting a lot of pressure on hiring. We are hiring at this moment. In fact, we just started a new hire class, I believe, last week out in our training facility in Denver.
Now, with one of our sister podcasts, the Airline Pilot Guy, there's a big war between two different pilots, one that flies a beautiful side-stick Airbus and one that flies one of those, you know, full yoke jets, you know, an egg yolk jet, a Boeing, and they argue back and forth about which one they like better. Now, obviously, you're flying the A320. How do you feel about the side stick? Because obviously, you had to transition to that.
I enjoy the Airbus. I enjoy the Airbus. I enjoy flying with the side stick and everything. That's what makes the Airbus unique. But in the years I've been at United, I've also flown many different Boeing airplanes, and both different manufacturers make a wonderful product. The important thing is United has an excellent training department. So when I decide I want to go fly long haul international again, that'll mean I'll fly the 777 or the 787. And you just forget everything about how the Airbus works and just concentrate on learning how to fly that model of Boeing airplanes. And it becomes your new favorite airplane.
So the transition's fairly easy going between the yoke and the side stick?
Oh, yes. It's very easy. Both of them are well-handling airplanes.
And flying the A320 now, the types of flying that you do, is that a lifestyle choice or is it a seniority choice? Or what really determines which aircraft you choose to fly?
For me, it was when I took an upgrade bid for captain, I didn't have any real particulars. It didn't matter which airplane it was going to be on. It was what aircraft and what base is going to give me that captain bid the soonest. And it happened to be here in Washington on the Airbus, which I flew as a first officer. So it was nothing new for me to learn.
Yeah, so you just had to use the muscles in your left arm as opposed to your right arm.
Now, Andy, you live in this area, is that right?
I do.
So have you been to this museum in the past?
Many times.
Many times.
It's one of my favorites. This one's the Uvarhazy Museum, obviously, is more of a hangar. So if you come to see airplanes, this is the one you come to. The one downtown D.C. is very nice also, but it's more exhibits.
Yes, yes. Now, they're doing some major renovation at the downtown location, I think.
I haven't been to it in a few years.
And they're doing something here, too. They're building
an
addition
on.
We'll have to ask, find out later what that's all about.
This is like the fourth year United has participated in this event, which is in the backyard of our Washington, D.C. hub. So we're just very happy to participate and talk to the public, let them see some of our airplanes. And
so we have the 777 out back.
Yes, we do.
Last year, was it a 767 last year?
Or the year before. But you guys definitely have the longest line of any of the displays out there. People are waiting in line for a long time to see the cabin.
For some of those people, yes, it's their first time that they've even been on a 777. And so they get to see the whole thing. We're very happy to have them on board. They'll walk through the entire airplane, sit in the seats, go up into the cockpit.
Yeah, it's fun.
It is fun.
It's really a nice day.
And it's really, I think, very nice that United participates in this event in that way. And especially for the kids. I mean,
the kids love it.
The kids love it, and it's a great day for them. So yeah, I'm just really happy that United is.
All of us are here today for this event. I think we're all airplane geeks. Yes.
Yes, for sure, for sure. All right. Well, thanks for spending a few minutes with us and in our audience. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoy it.
And I look forward to being on a flight with you soon.
I'll see you the next time on an Airbus.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Bye bye.
Now we're joined by Cadet Second Lieutenant Corey and Cadet Tech Sergeant Smith, both from the Civil Air Patrol. So both of you, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
So tell us a little bit about the Civil Air Patrol. I think most of our listeners understand what it is, but why don't you just give us a sort of a brief description of the Civil Air Patrol, what it does.
Okay, so the Civil Air Patrol is the Air Force Auxiliary unit, and it has a cadet program, but overall it's a world-class search and rescue organization. So we as cadets participate in that portion, but we're mainly in the cadet program, which is leadership skills and character enrichment and things like that. So it's really interesting because it covers aerospace topics and PT topics and drill and all sorts of really fascinating parts of cadet life there.
And how long have you been in the Civil Air Patrol?
So I have been in the Civil Air Patrol for 4 years, and Cadet Smith has been in for 2 now.
And why did you become interested in joining?
Personally, I joined because my older brother was in it already. I was just blown out of the water by the cool uniforms, but now I've come to appreciate its the leadership you learn as a cadet. It's just an experience you don't get anywhere else. The leadership experience, the aerospace knowledge that you just absorb over time, and the emergency services training I've received throughout my classes in the Civil Air Patrol.
What are the classes like? Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Well, generally you do a squadron meeting once a week, but there's also all sorts of other like extra activities that you can go to. During the squadron meetings, they're all mostly cadet planned, so it can be anything from a sit-down seminar to a hands-on activity. There's a rocketry group we have. I was aerospace NCO for the squadron for a little while, and we did aerospace presentations once a month, and we did it on all sorts of topics, usually from the textbooks that we do tests on. And then we also have really cool leadership classes, which are actually really interesting because older cadets will go up and tell sort of like leadership things that they've done and how that went and stuff like that.
This sounds really exciting, Micah. This is really cool stuff.
It sounds just fascinating. And now you're apparently Second Lieutenant Corey. Only just realized that you got into your technical sergeant. I guess you were a sergeant before that and just increased in rank. Tell us a little bit about the ranks and how do you earn your rank within the Civil Air Patrol?
So the link process, we have a lot of different ranks going through 3 airman ranks, multiple sergeant and chief ranks, and then up to the officer level, going through lieutenant, captain, major, and colonel. So to promote, it's a whole process. You have to go through a variety of testing. Aerospace testing, you read a manual that has all of the details you need to know, and you take a test on that. Drill testing, so that's marching and facing movements, such as saluting and turning around, information. Leadership testing, so a test based on leadership knowledge you learn, and physical fitness testing as well.
How much time does this take? It sounds like it's an awful lot.
It's actually not too long, sir. Our weekly meetings are 2 hours, I think, maybe three. It's about 2 hours. If you can really take as much time or as little as you want. We have the command staff cadets who are basically in charge of the squadron on the cadet side, and they spend anywhere from like 3 to 5 to 20 hours a week, no matter how, it depends on what's happening that week. But cadets who are just coming as airmen in can spend anywhere from just the 2 hours for the meeting to, if they have like a leadership position within their flight, they can spend longer. It really just, it's what you put into it.
Now, when you think Civil Air Patrol, oftentimes, you know, you're always thinking about flying and piloting and things like that, but there's a lot more to it than just flying and piloting, I'm assuming. What other kinds of, you talked a little bit about rocketry, and you talked about some of the leadership. What other kinds of areas of learning and of activities take place within the CAP?
We do have a variety of summer camps, which do cover Flight Academy, where you learn how to fly, you can solo. But also, we have cyber academies. You learn how to handle cyberspace, how to hack, how to protect against hacking. We have, again, rocketry. Another thing we do is honor guard, which may be confused with color guard used during marching band or something. But in reality, it's very similar to the U.S. Air Force Honor Guard. We do rifle drill, tossing, spinning, and if you're lucky, catching the rifles. We work as a funeral detail, honoring fallen members. Sometimes, rarely, we are called upon to present colors at weddings. We just, as a rule, like very often, we present the colors just in general. And also, our drill team has the opportunity to perform drill sequences with our rifles.
What age, what's the minimum age to start the cadet program?
That's 12, sir. It goes from 12 to 21, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we have people that download and listen from, well, all over the world and certainly all over the country, and they might not know. In fact, I live up in Portland, Maine, and I didn't know that there was a Civil Air Patrol organization up there until only 10 years ago, and I've lived there about 30 years. How do you go about finding where you can join and become a part of the Civil Air Patrol?
If you wish to find a squadron in your area, and we have them all over the U.S., including Puerto Rico and Alaska and Hawaii, you simply go to gocivilairpatrol.com. There will be a search tab where you can enter your town, your state, your zip code, and it'll tell you the closest squadrons to where you are.
Fascinating. Now, I can imagine that maybe both of you are different individuals in some ways than you were before you joined the program, the patrol. Maybe each of you tell us a little bit about the biggest changes that you personally think that you've experienced as a result of being part of the CAP.
Well, I haven't been in as long as Lieutenant Corey has, but I've definitely learned a lot during my time in Civil Air Patrol. It's primarily been how to work with other people, people under and over you in rank and just in position. It's because I did some leadership things out as extracurriculars anyway, but Civil Air Patrol is really, it helps you learn all sorts of things, especially how to be professional and still kind. Because there's sort of a line that you have to draw between, you know, being, you know, you're in uniform, so there's kind of a sense you've got to set on yourself about how you're representing your squadron, you're representing the U.S. Air Force, and you have to kind of take that into account. But at the same time, you are there to have a good time, and you are there to learn new things and enjoy yourself. So definitely how to present yourself and maintain bearing, I think, is a good one.
I would have to concur with Tech Sergeant Smith. I do personally believe one of the most important things I've learned in Civilian Patrol is discipline overall, my self-discipline, how to teach others that quality, and also leadership, self-leadership, leadership for others, how to work and bond and cooperate with a team, like the value of your own opinion, how to work with other people to ensure everyone's needs are met. It's just invaluable experience.
And how about your aspirations? Where do you think you'll go with all this?
Well, Civil Air Patrol kind of was... I joined Civil Air Patrol because of my aspirations, and it kind of confirmed and sort of pointed them, focused them more. Beforehand, I always wanted to be in sort of some sort of aviation, whether it be like astronomy side or the actual pilot side. But now that I'm in Civil Air Patrol, I'm really looking into doing ROTC in college and then going into the Air Force for a few years. Maybe for my whole career, I'm not quite certain yet. I'm only a sophomore. But Civil Air Patrol has definitely opened a lot of avenues because they're very good about every time you go to an event, there will be professionals to talk to you about it. I've been spoken to at events by the Air National Guard came and did a presentation. I didn't know they existed until then, but it's a really fascinating way to be both a civilian and in the military at the same time. There's also a lot of cybersecurity careers that they talk to you about. There's also all sorts of course, military-based, but there's a lot of civilian ones that come in and speak to you about the things that you're learning as well. So it's really fantastic for career choices.
For me personally, I never even considered the military as a career before I joined the Civil Air Patrol. Before I joined the Civil Air Patrol, I had no idea where I was going with my life. But now that I've been in it for a few years, I'm actually considering a career similar to Smith, Air Force ROTC in college, and or maybe even Air Force Academy, and then moving on to join the Air Force and proceed with my career from there.
To be clear, though, CAP doesn't try and make officers or even Air Force members. Like I say, very few of the people in our Civil Air Patrol Squadron have gone on to be in the Air Force, but no matter what you do, it really teaches you incredible life skills, whether it be time management or just how to work with people or how to present yourself properly or just so much discipline and just general knowledge. It's amazing.
That's fantastic. What an impressive pair of young ladies here.
Absolutely fabulous, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time. And also, I want to publicly apologize for making you guys wait so long.
Yes, you're very patient. Very
good. Absolutely, no problem.
We got a little stacked up here with our interviews. So thanks again, and have a great day. And I hope you talk to a lot of people, and help others understand what the Civil Air Patrol is and what it has to offer. I think you've done a lot to help our audience, and that's great. We thank you for that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having us, sir.
All right. Well, I wasn't expecting a positive airline story of the week, but Brian, you were on an airline just 12 hours ago or something?
Yeah, less than 12 hours ago.
Less than 12 hours
ago. Yeah, and I haven't slept yet, so that'll explain some. Flew in United from Los Angeles to Washington Dulles, and I have to say this is probably the best flight I've had in the past 10 years.
Wow, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, so the flight, the gate agents were kind and courteous and efficient. So the plane boarded quickly. The flight attendants did an outstanding job. United's changed up the meal service, and one of the dishes they had was a beef stew. And my only criticism of the, and I know this is going to sound really weird, my only criticism of the meal is there wasn't enough of it.
Small portion?
No, it was totally proportioned. I just would have eaten more had there been more. It was actually that good.
Oh.
So that's what I'm really surprised at, is it was a great meal. Again, the flight attendants did an excellent job.
You know, that's really unusual for you, Brian, because usually what you say when you get off the plane is the food was terrible and such small portions.
Yeah.
The captain did a great job of communicating and making his announcements. We landed a few minutes early, and again, it was just it was a flight experience that I was used to having 10 years ago and was just really surprised on how well everything turned out. So hats off to United for doing an excellent job.
What type were you on flying over?
It was a 737-900.
And were you up front or were you in the back?
No, I was up front. Okay. This isn't United's issue. Well, I guess it is because they choose the size of the lavatories. The 900 has the tiniest lavatory in the entire fleet. I had to step outside to change my mind. It was so incredibly small. But again, that's just it. The aircraft is what it is, and I understand all the airlines are moving to that configuration. And we saw at the Boeing Delivery Center, Max, when you and I were up there in Seattle, they're just tiny. And yeah. That's
what was the load like? The plane full or?
There was 5 or 6 empty seats. So yeah, it was pretty full, and up front it most certainly was full.
How about the airport experience? I always find that baggage claim tends to take a long time. At least it does at the Hartford Airport in Bradley.
Right. Well, since I'm here only for the weekend, I just had a carry-on. I didn't have to deal with that. The other thing about Los Angeles Airport, United is pretty much done with the rehab of Terminal 7. And I have to say, they've done a really good job. So it's light and airy. Very bright, so they've added some more windows. I talked with one of my friends at the club, and the new Polaris Lounge, they say that it's still on schedule to open in December. It's unfortunate that it's about 2 years behind schedule, and I think it's unfortunate that United is making an announcement over a true premium economy for international. They've made the announcement, but the planes are still way far away from actually taking delivery of the seats and outfitting the planes. So just like Polaris, there are still many aircraft that they have that aren't configured with the Polaris seats. Yeah. But the club is now open in Newark. There's one in San Francisco and the one in Chicago, and they're all getting really good reviews. So
nice.
Yeah.
And so the trip back, also on United, probably?
Yeah, it'll be on United. I currently am in economy, so we'll see if the upgrade clears on that. I think it'll be a little bit more difficult because it's actually the configuration of plane. It's a 757 that has the PS seat, so it's the equivalent of the international business class seat, so the lie-flat seat. So they tend to go at a premium, and the planes fill up pretty fast. So I'm assuming I'm going to be sitting in the back of the bus on this one. And but again, if the service is the way it was coming over, I'll be quite happy.
All right, good. Well, we'll look forward to your report after you return home. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, next week. Thanks.
We have a listener guest with us today, someone who is such a dedicated listener to not only the airplane geeks, but to the airline pilot guy, that she flew down from New York City for the day to come see us. And I want to introduce you to Tanya Wyman.
Hello. Very, very, very good to talk to you, airplane geeks. And this is so much fun. We're just having a really nice day going around, seeing all the nice general aviation aircraft that are not usually here, and just seeing all the displays. It's really, really wild.
Now, you've never been to the Udvar-Hazy Center before, have you?
No, I haven't.
So tell us, because you're a true airplane geek, you love aircraft, what was it like when you walked inside?
It's really overwhelming. There's so many planes here, so many different things here. We just went through the space wing and saw the space shuttle, which I'd seen the space shuttle in New York as well, but this one, it's like you can see all around it. You can see underneath it. It's really fascinating.
It's amazing when you first walk past the entryway to that wing, and you're looking at it and you go, oh my God, there's a space shuttle.
Yeah, yes. Just nose on.
Nose on, right. Your first view.
Absolutely, yes.
Was it as big as you thought or smaller than you thought?
It was bigger than I thought.
It was bigger than I thought, too, the first time I saw it. Yeah, yeah.
And I was just saying, the way that they left it all, you know, as it was very beaten up from the last flight, it's amazing that they actually flew these things more than once. It's like, I just don't know what went into getting them ready to fly again. It's just astounding.
And Tanya, that's actually one of the interesting things about this museum, in that some museums are all about perfect restorations of the aircraft. So everything looks brand new or even better than new. And they generally don't do that here. They like to show the aircraft in the condition that the aircraft are in. Not that there's wrecks or anything, but...
Right.
And the other aspect of it is that they always make sure that the displays have some historical significance. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, that model airplane. It's that particular airplane that performed this sort of, you know, historical activity that makes it interesting. So it's great.
And what's really also interesting about the Udvar-Hazy Center and the Smithsonian Institute Air and Space Museum is that they don't really even refer... We refer to everything as displays, and we think about it as a display. There's a display of the Enola Gay, and there's a display of that F4U Corsair. But they're not displays. They think of them as artifacts, and they're preserving artifacts, which makes it even more important when you think about it.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So of all the aircraft on display, what's your most favorite?
Oh, boy, it's so hard.
If you had to pick one, which would it be?
You know, you're actually right underneath it, but I have to say the Enola Gay, because it's just, it's so enormous and so stunning. It's really, really wild.
Hey, have you been outside yet?
Yes.
Because most of us haven't yet. Well, Brian, no, you have not?
I just peeked outside, but okay. No, I haven't had a chance to walk around yet.
Yeah, we didn't go in the 777 because Philip's like, it's just an airplane. That's my boyfriend, by the way.
Yeah, but it's nice seeing the various configurations. Yeah,
absolutely.
The different cabins, I mean. And so if you haven't been in one, I'd suggest going through. And also the size of the 777 is...
Yeah, it's huge.
Pretty impressive, yes.
Which is different than, I guess, the aircraft. Did you fly down on a 737 or an MD-80?
No.
Or
it was completely the opposite of the 777. It was a CRJ-200.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So not quite the smallest, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
And Tanya, I like the T-shirt that you're wearing. You've got a Fly Acme Airlines T-shirt from Airline Pilot Guy.
Well, honestly, I got sucked into this through the Airline Pilot Guy show. I had always kind of been interested in aviation, but I would never have considered myself an av geek. So this is all very, very recent for me. But there's another podcast I listen to, and they like have a live stream, so they broadcast other podcasts when they're not broadcasting, and they had the Airline Pilot Guy on it, and I just happened to hear it after the end of their show, and I was like, oh, what's this silver-tongued Captain Jeff? You know, I got to listen to this, and of course, you know, the rest of the hosts are just so great, and that's what I love about that podcast, and also your podcast as well, is it's not just informational, it's funny, you know, you get to know the personalities, and so that kind of sucked me in. And then, you know, through that community, which is great, you know, I got in touch with Micah, and now I started listening to your podcast, and it's just a really amazing community. It really is.
So was it Captain Jeff's silver tongue or his silver mustache that that attracted
probably
you?
Probably both, but the tongue initially, because I didn't know what he looked like. The dulcet tones.
That's right. Well, Tanya, we hope you have a great day at the museum here. Are you going to be joining us for dinner afterwards over at the Red Robin?
Yes, absolutely.
Perfect.
I will be there.
All right, good. So we'll see you there as well. All right.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. This is such a treat.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for coming down and seeing us. It means a lot to us. Thank you.
Very nice.
Thanks.
We're here with Eric Galler. He's the producer-director of an interesting program, The Science of Flight. This is an educational series that's got some recordings. And Eric, tell us a little bit about what The Science of Flight is all about.
Sure. The Science of Flight is a 24-piece series that was produced in cooperation with the Great Courses and the Smithsonian Institution. And it features both... about 25 Smithsonian curators, including John Anderson. John Anderson literally wrote the book on aeronautical engineering, which is used by every aero engineering student these days. So that was a real pleasure to work with him. So it's a 24-piece series, and we did shoot on location at both museums, and we also was on location at the Aviation Institute of Maintenance, which is here in Manassas.
So this program includes, as you said, it's 24 lectures.
Yeah,
they're about 30 minutes each, so it's a lot of material. And it covers a number of different topics. Maybe talk a little bit about sort of the progression of the topics.
All right. Well, it's a four DVD set. The main host is James Gregory, who's a professor at Ohio State University, and he takes you through. Oh, it's almost like two semesters of aero engineering. And we cover everything from wing design, from the outside, from air pressure. We take you inside of wind tunnels, both historically and modern. Throughout the 24 lectures, we start from lighter than air, and we take you all the way through to the latest X-plane, the heavy rockets, everything in between. And we go through what makes these airplanes fly, what's different, the progression on what drove the aviation industry, you know, farther, further, higher, and, you know, the particular aeronautical designs, why is a wing shaped the way a wing is shaped? What happens to the air around it? We talk about yaw, pitch. You know, if you've ever kind of wondered what those dials were on an airplane, that tells you how does a pilot know how high that airplane is or how fast it's going really? What's coming at you? It's almost like a great supplement for any pilot out there. In fact, some of our biggest fans are commercial airline pilots. Sure, they know how to fly, but now they're actually learning about the science of flight. You know, what's making their airplane lift? And we talk about the big failures in aircraft design. You know, why did some of those early planes come down? Why are the windows on an airplane why are they not square? Why are the windows on an airplane not square? Why are they have rounded edges? What's that all about? Who came up with that design? And when? We talk about the flight failures like Sully, the crash in the Hudson River, and so the program itself features some wonderful digital recreations. There's a lot of wonderful images, historical images. It is for anybody who loves airplanes. Those that have been working in the aviation industry for years and just want a refresher, and anyone who just wants to learn a little bit more about what makes airplanes do what they do.
Is there an age group that is primarily targeted here?
You know, it's I think our youngest I've seen so far was 13, and it's, you know, it's at a collegiate level, but it's designed so that anyone with any level of education can turn it on and learn something. There's some heavy math, but you just skip over the heavy math. You power through it. You don't have to be a math whiz to understand some of the basic, you know, aeronautical.
I was going to rephrase that question in a different manner. As the producer director of this kind of documentation and classes, there are a lot of different ways that you can do it in terms of how you're going to present it. So as a producer and director, when you were thinking about it and putting it together in your head, who was your target audience?
Yeah, my target audience was probably anywhere from 18 to around 65. That's the official line, but it really is for anyone who wants to learn about aviation and aeronautics. And we do cover, like I said, we start at the beginning and we work our way all the way through. And it's not just a fluff piece where we're saying, oh, you know, we really do cover the failures. The science of flight has a lot of failures, and they say the only way to learn is through our failures. And so we also include the space shuttle as well. We talk in depth about, you know, the external skin of the space shuttle. Why is it the way it is? You know, what are those black panels? Why does it look like it's wrapped in an old quilt? And then we covered this. And it's, you know, you asked, who is this really for? Anyone, you know, with a ninth grade education is going to be able to follow along. Again, some of the math is a little tough, but it's not just about math. We have wonderful three-dimensional and two-dimensional diagrams to walk you through.
So this sounds like it's something that would be of interest to people who have some aviation background, but also people who maybe don't and would like to learn more about it.
Yeah. In fact, one of my coworkers who has probably worked on over 500 somewhat projects for the Great Courses, and the Great Courses has a library of over, I believe, 700 projects now for our viewers. And she said to me that she learned more on the science of flight than any other project. And she's worked, like I said, she probably worked on over 500. And this is the one that knocked her socks off. It really did.
That must be very rewarding for you hearing that from someone like that as you being having produced and directed it.
It is. And I think I mentioned that, you know, a lot of people that I hear, and we get feedback from the people that have watched it. You know, we get comments. And I was really surprised on how many professional pilots and commercial aviators have watched it and have loved it and have recommended it to their coworkers. Yeah, the Science of Flight.
All right, Eric, where do people find the Science of Flight?
Science of Flight, you can find it at thegreatcourses.com.
Great. All right. Well, thanks, Eric, for bringing this to our attention and coming and talking with us and our audience. I think this sounds like something that's really an exciting piece of work, something that I'm going to look forward to going through. It's going to take a while, 24 segments, but it sounds like, you know, when you look at the topics covered here, they're all, you know, fascinating. Helicopters and vertical flight, aerobatics and dogfighting, primary cockpit instruments. I mean, all this is just some great AvGeek stuff. So any other projects that you're working on that might be interesting? It might be related to aviation or aerospace?
Yeah, I'm not doing another aviation. We did another project with Smithsonian called Life in the World's Oceans. So that's, you know, we covered air. Now we're doing the world of oceans. So, yeah, which is, completely different beast. But I recommend that one as well. That's available and that's out there.
Different pressure, so to speak.
Different pressure, absolutely. Absolutely. But I tell you, it was interesting. Some of the concepts that when we were dealing with talking about, why whales, how whales stay down, how they keep their balance, the buoyancy, and the pressure, it's very similar to airplanes and how airplanes function, the streamlining, you know. I mean, airplanes do kind of look like they look like porpoises in the sky. So, yep, flying whales.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're here with Captain Rick Bell. Rick, nice to see you again. Last time I saw you was in Pittsburgh.
That's right. Yeah. Nice to see you guys, too.
For the air show, which you had more than a small role in producing, I think.
Tiny role. Very, very minute.
Some people called it Wings Over Pittsburgh. We called it the Rick Show.
Rick Show.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And one of the things that we talked about then was that at the time we were going to see a transition from the C-130s to the C-17s. So maybe you can give our listeners a little update on how that progressed.
Yeah, we are in the midst of the transition now. So what you saw back in 2017 with the ramp and how everything looked is no longer the case. The ramp's all torn up. The airplanes are gone. So all of our C-130s are no longer in Pittsburgh. So they're all now out in the system. And the construction on all the hangars has started. The hangars that you saw that were there are no longer. They're either getting remodeled or renovated. And they're starting to build the new two-bay hangar for the C-17. So it's a total different world now.
And you yourself just transitioned from the C-130 to the C-17 flying. And that happened in the past 2 months, more or less.
It did, actually. My last flight in the C-130 was in January. And then at the end of January, I went to C-17 school.
And what was it like transitioning as a pilot? Because I remember you talking a little bit when we were chatting personally, and you said that landing is a completely different experience when you're in a C-17.
It really is. It's not a traditional aircraft in the sense that when you come into land, you push the stick forward to make the nose go down, adjust yourself on glide slope by using, you know, back pressure on the stick or, you know, forward pressure. It lands using backside flying, as we call it. And it actually, you get on the backside of the pitch and power curve, where using the throttles and the power is what's actually going to go and change either going, you know, climbing or descending. And your pitch is what you use to actually control your airspeed. So pushing forward on the forward from the nose, you know, pushing forward on the stick. In a traditional aircraft, make the nose go down, right? You adjust your glide slope or, you know, decrease your altitude. When you get into a landing configuration in the C-17, you push forward on the stick to actually increase your airspeed. It doesn't really do anything to what your actual glide slope is. If you want to change your glide slope or change your altitude, you actually have to increase or decrease power. And it's all because of those big flaps on the back of that wing of that airplane. It actually creates a powered lift concept. The engines are actually now, it's almost like vectored lift, I guess, or vectored thrust is what you'd call it.
Interesting. So how are you liking those Pratt engines?
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's great, huh?
They're powerful, man. 40,400 pounds of thrust per engine. We got four of them. So they're thirsty, though, too. They drink a lot of gas.
Quite a bit different experience than with the engines on the C-130.
Yeah. You know, the Allison T-56s, the turboprops. I think there's actually a display of the Allison over in the corner there, over by where all the engines and everything are. It was a fantastic motor. And now, you know, going to a straight jet, you know, it's a different world. It's a different, you know, whole different experience.
You're flying as a reserve officer. You've been flying. I mean, you've been called in and been flying pretty steadily for the past since we saw you in Pittsburgh last year.
Yeah, absolutely. Since Pittsburgh, I went to instructor school for the C-130, and then came back and did a tour as an instructor at the unit, at the squadron, and then the squadron deployed for 4 or 5 months. They came back, and I went right to C-17 school. So I've been doing a lot of flying in the past year.
But at some point, your other job is you also fly for Acme Junior, flying the E-170, E-175.
I do.
And how, now that you've been flying the C-17 for so long and with that whole new strange landing procedure, how do you feel you're going to transition when you're transitioning back and forth?
Don't know. I talk to my friends and everything about that too. It's a very different experience, and it's a different way of thinking. It's a different way of operating, and I don't know. We'll find out. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Now, over the past couple of days, you've been on a pretty interesting mission, going back and forth across the country. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, I'm thankful it worked out the way it did, but we're actually here because we're going through the transition. We're working with and flying with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the 445th Airlift Wing, because we don't have any airplanes yet. We did take a delivery of two of our airplanes that we are going to have assigned to us.
we've had a sort of, well, not a stranger, but Captain Jeff show up. He's been rubbing Rick's ears. That's why we're...
Where was I? What were we talking about? It's very distracting.
To have your ears rubbed from behind, yeah.
Yeah, we took delivery of two of our aircraft. They're actually with Pittsburgh Tails now. They're painted up, and they have the Pittsburgh markings and everything on it. So we've been flying with them. They're actually helping us. Back to the question. We actually came down here for it called an ICMOP. I don't know what it stands for, but it's basically the Air Force's flying ambulance service. So what would happen is wounded, injuries related or unrelated to combat, especially if they're overseas, they bring them to Andrews, to the medical center here in Washington, D.C. So process them, get them patched up. And then we will take them around the country to whatever medical appointments that they need, or if they need to go to some sort of, if they're going home, you know, getting taken home or sent home. So that's our responsibility now. So we're moving them around the country. We were scheduled actually to go to Andrews, and then from Andrews to go out to San Antonio, and then end up in Travis, and then from Travis up to Washington, and then across. And we weren't actually supposed to be back until late tonight, but thank goodness we weren't needed. So we went to San Antonio yesterday, and then came right home, and are right back here to Andrews. And today, now we have the weekend off. So that's a good thing, I think, with it, when it comes to this mission. So if they don't need us, then perfect.
Fantastic. Now, do we have a C-17 outside?
We sure do.
I haven't even been outside yet. That's
yeah. There sure is.
But you didn't fly that one in.
No, I didn't fly that one in. No, that's, I think, McCord, I believe. Or McGuire. McGuire, actually.
But you can start it up, so can you take me home?
Yeah. I'd like to. I would really like to.
Rick, thank you so much for coming by. It's so great to see you. It really is.
It's great to see you guys, too. This has been awesome. I'm really excited to be here and be able to be here with you guys today.
It's a great event. It's a great event. Are we going to see a show in Pittsburgh?
Not anytime soon. Well, we don't even have a ramp right now to be able to actually give you guys a show. So hopefully, probably in the next 5 years, I'm really hoping that we'd be able to actually do one again. So, but when we do, you guys will be there. So,
absolutely. You bet. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we're joined by Bjorn, who just, you also flew in today for this event.
I flew in. Unfortunately, they didn't allow me to park at the apron here, but I flew in an A380 this morning. We landed 8 o'clock just at the Dulles Airport here.
And let's just clarify that. You flew in, you weren't the passenger, you were the pilot.
Yes, I was in the left-hand seat here.
How long have you been flying the A380?
I've been on the A380 for just under 5 years now, and been flying Airbuses for the last 25 or so.
Oh, where did you come from before the A380?
I flew in Belgium, my home country, for the national airline there.
Ah, yeah. Belgium. I haven't been to Belgium in so long. Belgium is such a great country. There's a lot...
great beer, isn't it?
A lot of great food, the great beer, yes.
Beer, chocolate, and food.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, I've been fortunate enough to be on an A380 one time in Farnborough 2 years ago, and it was an empty one. It was Airbus brought it there, and it was going to be retired after, so it was completely empty, nothing inside. And I had the opportunity to sit in the right seat for a little bit, didn't fly it, but sat in the right seat, toured it all through, and it's bigger than about four of my houses put together. So as a pilot, what's it like to handle? What does it feel like when you're in there? Is it because you've transitioned from other aircraft, obviously?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's remarkably humble. It's remarkably sensitive as well on the flight controls. Actually, it's much closer to one of the smaller Airbuses, like an A319, maybe even an A320. An A330 or an A340 is definitely much heavier on the controls than the A380 is. It's actually very, very sensitive at the flight controls kind of thing, which is nice. That's what we want as pilots. A good responsive airplane. It's by far the best flying Airbus I've ever flown. I've pretty much flown them all now, except for the A350.
So it's really far more nimble than it looks.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Obviously, it's all artificial. It's all fly-by-wire. It's how they program the computers.
How did you, let's just go back to the very beginnings.
Sure.
Of your aviation interest, let's say. What was the first plane you flew, or where did you start all of this?
I'm 47 now, and I just celebrated my 30th year of flying last year. So I started young, born in two parents that were pilots as well, flying as well. So pretty much brought up amongst airplane, a real airplane geek, if you want.
Yes.
Yeah. And since then I've gradually built up my experience, obviously, and eventually I am flying now. But I still love general aviation, small aircraft a lot as well. I have a little Piper Cub which I still fly in my days off as well.
So did you get your first flight instruction in Europe?
Yeah. That's where I'm from, and I'm from Belgium, and that's where I actually learned to fly as well. Yeah.
What's the general aviation scene like in Belgium these days?
It is very different. I mean, we often hear, obviously, the States is the prime example still of aviation friendly, kind of, even though things are not what they used to be years ago. But Europe is definitely much stricter, much more expensive. I would say the best aviation-minded countries in Europe are probably France and the UK. Germany probably in there as well. And then Belgium isn't really at the top of that list. It's kind of, being a small country, it's obviously quite restrictive in airspace and stuff like that. But it's, yeah, we still do our thing, and we still get to fly quite often. So
you get some opportunities to do some flying yourself.
And yes, we do. And that's obviously the real flying is still the little airplane.
Yes, yes. You know, David and I do a podcast about drones. And one of the things we talk about frequently is concerns from pilots about all this unmanned activity going on.
It's funny you ask. I'm just, because I'm on the side, I'm an aviation photographer as well. I do a lot of photography on the side. And obviously the whole drone business interests me as well. I can see some people being worried. What I'm personally worried about is people that just fly their drones irresponsibly, that they don't follow the rules. I have absolutely no problem with people that just follow the rules and fly where they're allowed to fly, but not really. Kind of, I mean, let's hope for the best and let's try and make a dramatic airplane picture from somewhere over LAX or JFK or something like that. Yeah.
You haven't had any close encounters yourself.
I've seen a few.
Yeah, have
yeah,
you?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Not really close, but I've seen a few.
Yeah. It is a big concern.
Yeah, it definitely is.
So what's your favorite airport or let's change it around. What's your least favorite airport to bring a 380 into?
That's a hard one. I'm going to make some enemies here, right? Probably I would say JFK, because it's a 1960s kind of airport, which hasn't really runways and taxiways are very narrow, and it's probably the most challenging one, I would say, just purely from a ground perspective. Obviously, once the approaches and stuff like that is all fine, and the fact obviously that it is very busy, it's probably the most challenging one, especially on the ground.
Oh boy, our gang at NYC Aviation
are
not going to be happy. But no, I think JFK's got some of the narrowest taxiways ever, so I can understand that.
They do, and especially then the challenge is obviously wintertime with the weather. If it's they have this white stuff, I can't remember what exactly it's called, but if that's on the ground, then it's obviously that's makes it even more challenging.
So are you on layover now?
I'm just on a short layover, 36-hour layover. I'm heading out tomorrow morning again.
Different plane, different aircraft?
Different plane, but obviously the same type. Yeah, another sure, A380. Sure. Yeah.
So as a pilot, how much time do you get in terms of layovers? Do you have a lot of long layovers?
It kind of varies. Obviously, the length of the flight plays a role. The longer the flight is, normally, generally speaking, the longer you stay as well. But then the main thing is actually the frequency of the flight. If it's a daily flight, you often just stay 24 hours and you pick up the next airplane basically on the way back home again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So do you hope to be flying the A380 for many, many more years? Or is there something else that you have your eye on at this point?
I wouldn't say so. No, probably the smaller the better nowadays. Kind of, I'm slowly starting to think smaller aircraft even more than the biggest one. Obviously, it is what it is. But I'll be there for a while probably.
I was going to ask along those same lines, from a pilot's perspective, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, retirement of the four-engine jets in general, and A380s are having a hard time selling them right now. Where do you see what's happening with the A380s that are currently in service? Do you think they're going to be remaining there for a while?
It's going to be there for a while. Obviously, I mean, there's still orders coming. It is a unique market, and I do believe it's more than likely the last four-engine large jet aircraft kind of... at least for the foreseeable future, I would say. It is still being improved upon performance-wise and stuff like that. So there's definitely a market for it, and some companies obviously do it very well. Passengers like it, and it works both ways. Let's put it that way, kind of. It's a bit of the chicken and the egg kind of question. But,
Maybe one last question before we let you go, Bjorn. And this is another one of our favorite questions for airline pilots particularly. Do you think we'll ever see a future where there are unmanned airliners?
I mean, of course. I mean, if we, the four of us, will see the future, that's maybe something. I mean, but somebody who's 16, 18 now is more than likely going to see, I think, at least initially maybe for freighter, for cargo operations. And then obviously, I don't think we'll get rid of both pilots together, so we'll probably go to the step first of one pilot on a big airliner, and it is going to happen. It's just a matter of time, but it's probably not for tomorrow.
Right.
After my time.
Yes, hopefully. All right. Well, Bjorn, thank you for stopping by. Thanks for coming to the event today. Hope you have a great time the rest of the day.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.
Oh, the flan. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you mean I missed flan?
Yes.
Oh, my hell.
Oh, homemade flan, because she makes the caramel, too.
Oh, God.
She makes the caramel, too. To me, that's the best part, is breaking the sugar off the pan and eating it.
Oh, don't even rub it.
Oh, yeah, that's the picture. I took a picture of it. I said to your mother-in-law, I said to her, I said, can I move in? And you know what her response was?
Yeah.
Sure, you just got to pay rent.
We've got enough rooms. I mean, it's great.
It's that was fun.
And I hopefully did a good enough job cleaning up that maybe we can do it next year if I'm off of work.
That was wonderful. For those of you listening, since we're recording.
Oh, are we recording this? Already?
Well, I already started. So we might as well. We met at dispatcher Mike's in-law's house close by, about
20 minutes.
Well, the traffic around here, it took an hour for me to get there and about 30 minutes to come back to the
hotel.
That's
commitment.
Yeah. Well, the we were talking about the flan. The flan made it worthwhile. It was a great day. So anyway, we're happy to have Dispatcher Mike on with us on the Airplane Geeks podcast. How did you get to this event today?
I got here by flying. Good friends with Hillel, and Hillel has brought his Cherokee before. And I asked him, "Well, how did you get your Cherokee in?" He goes, "Well, you have to be invited, but there's a form you can apply." I'm like, "Well, if I don't apply, the answer is going to be no. But if I just fill out the form, you know, we'll see what happens." And amazingly, the Smithsonian said, "Yes, we'd love to have your 1963 Beechcraft Musketeer come in." So I came up yesterday with my good friend Captain Jeff and I flew up from Atlanta yesterday, made one stop along the way. It was awesome flying in here to Dulles. I've done it many times. As a dispatcher, we have the opportunity or the requirement to sit in the cockpit jump seat. So we have to do that five hours every year. So that gives us jump seat access. So I've come into Dulles before, in the pointy end of the airplane, but it never steering the airplane. So that was fun. The Potomac controllers were great, very, very accommodating of us in our lack of speed that we have usually on final. So I came in here, landed yesterday, got to taxi through the ramp to get over to the FBO, which was just amazing to do. And then I... And then this morning, just taxied down here to the Smithsonian, which again was a lot of fun. I was talking to Jeff, because Jeff was in the airplane with me, that the taxiway Juliet that we came down here on, is about as wide as the runway at my home airport. I'm like, this taxiway is massive. I'm like, I could do zigzags and be fine and have no clearance. And like, to him, this is no big deal. It's just a taxiway. But when he comes to the general aviation airports, that's a different story because everything's smaller and narrower.
So with your trip up here, you said they had to stop. Was that for a bio break or fuel or food or
the fuel? It was a fuel stop. So it was a tech stop. So in the airline world, we'd call it tech stop. You know, you're getting gas, you're changing crew, passengers stay the same. So we needed to fill two tanks. We needed to fill the fuel tank and the food tank, and then we needed to empty the bladder tank. So two tanks got full and one tank got emptied. And then we needed to hit a window here, so it was a very quick stop. We were about, I think it was about 30 minutes we were on the ground, and then we were back on our way.
What's it like flying with Captain Jeff? Does he behave himself? Or?
Oh, Jeff is an absolutely, he's a pilot's pilot. You can give him everything. He took the controls. He's just like, wait, I get to fly? I'm like, yeah, you're going to get to fly a lot. So we kind of split it up. Every hour, 90 minutes, we switched out who was flying, just to give airplane doesn't have an autopilot. We have a trim wheel, and that's as close as we get, but it's pure hand flying the whole way. And Jeff was solid. I mean, just smooth and solid. And I've flown with him before in his other flying, the 88, and he flies the 88 the same way. It's just, he's a very smooth pilot. And it was great to have another very, very talented pilot fly up here with me. I mean, I think it needed to be a two-man crew, especially coming in here to the Potomac and all that. Like, when I needed to change some stuff inputted in the iPad, he's just like, all right, you take the airplane, I'll deal with this, and then we'll switch off.
Now, your airplane is probably older than you.
It is. It is 20 years older than I am. And, you know, I love it. I love the vintage airplane because a good vintage airplane allows you to park in the vintage area at Sun and Fun and park in the vintage area like I will be doing this year at Oshkosh. You get to bring your airplane and you park it in the vintage area. So now because you fly an old airplane, you get to park closer. And, you know, Jeff said yesterday, he goes, what's the difference between your airplane? And no one makes fun of you because of your airplane that's old, but everyone makes fun of me because the 88s and 90s are old. I'm like, well, mine's old enough to the point where it's called a vintage. Yours is just old.
So let me ask you a question about something else you do, because some of our audience members might not know exactly. We've introduced you as Dispatcher Mike, and you were a dispatcher for Acme. What does a dispatcher do?
A dispatcher is a Part 121 requirement that was slated. What a dispatcher does is all the flight planning for every single flight at an airline. So, for example, at one flight, a dispatcher, let's give it Washington to Chicago, Dallas to Chicago. You pull up the flight, and then you look at the aircraft. You make sure the aircraft is airworthy to go. You know, we have our maintenance team that does it, but are any things broken on the airplane that are going to prevent it from safely completing its flight? Okay, so airplane's good, let's go. Now we compute the flight plan. How high are we going to fly? What route are we going to go? Is there any weather in between? We build our route around that. Is there any turbulence? Say if there's turbulence at 35,000 feet. Well, it's optimal, but if I fly at 33,000 feet, all the passengers get a smooth ride. So we do that. And then we send all of that information, and we send it away, and it becomes about 20 feet of paper for the pilots to read. And then we look at the NOTAMs and all that at the origin and destination airports, specify any alternates. So it's all a bunch of flight planning, but that's not where our job ends. Our job ends when that flight gets into the next gate. We are the first point of contact for that flight crew of that flight if anything goes wrong, if they have an in-route maintenance problem, if they have a passenger issue, if the weather has changed completely different than what we had planned, then it's my role as a dispatcher to inform the crew that, hey, this has changed. So it's a constant flow of communication should be going on between the dispatcher and the flight crew. And we do this over ACARS, which is basically text messaging. So we text back and forth. in when you get into the ultra long haul flying like we do, I remember there was times where I used to take our flight from Johannesburg and I'd set it up and I'd release it and I'd watch them take off. And this is on the day shift. I'd go home, have the afternoon with my kids, go to sleep. And the first thing I did when I came back to work that next morning was watch my flight for the last half hour land. I was off duty the whole time while they were flying, and another dispatcher took over. But if I didn't put enough gas on the flight, I was really, really, you know, putting myself in a tight situation tomorrow. So I had no one else to blame except for myself for the next day.
I remember a specific situation that we had chatted about. Actually, we were able to do it as it was going on because we were talking, where you were dealing with an aircraft that was flying O'Hare to, I believe, Paris, and someplace, maybe it was Denver to Paris, and it lost a bathroom or two, and you had to figure out what you were going to do and if you were going to let it fly over the Atlantic because it was an issue. I don't know if you remember that specific thing.
Oh, absolutely, I remember.
And you came up with an amazing solution, but how do you handle those kinds of strange emergencies?
That's the stuff that it's what we get paid for. I still swear I should start taking notes and I'd have a really juicy memoir by the time I retired. But you know, in that situation, the destination airport never serviced the labs, and there was marked that the labs got serviced, so they're a quarter into the flight. And the labs are full. And once the labs get full, they stop flushing. You can't flush anymore. So they lost half the labs. And then it was a quick scramble. Well, did they actually service the labs? No. Okay. Well, there's 7 more hours of flying to go. And what are we going to do? And it was end up a divert to get the labs serviced, get more gas, and then continue on to Paris. We had to stop because we had to empty some tanks. So our passengers could empty their tanks for the rest of the flight.
Right, right. Well, you don't have a lav on your airplane, but I'm curious to know if your background and experience as a dispatcher makes you a different kind of GA pilot than other GA pilots.
And vice versa. As a GA pilot, does that change your ability to be a dispatcher?
Alrighty, I'll start with Max and Micah, because the answer to that is yes to both. At Sun and Fun this last couple of months ago, I did a forum of planning your GA flight like an airliner. And it does. I start looking, when I'm doing a long trip or doing any trip in the airplane, I am looking at the weather. I start flight planning 3 days prior, and I will sit and, thankfully with 4Flight. I mean, 4Flight is a great tool and it's really enhanced safety for aviation. But I remember even still when it allows us to continue to look at it, opposed to 10 years ago when I learned how to fly, it was pad, paper, E6B route, and you kind of just hit your checkpoints and you went. But 4Flight gives you so much more to do. But I'll run that same flight, like up here to the flight up here, I had different fuel stops. I had different, you know, different ways. I was using ground-based navigation. I was just using waypoints to go through or things like that So as a dispatcher, yes, because I see and I basically dispatch myself. You know, if I was working this up, if it was an airplane, an airliner, I look at the same stuff. You know, over the ocean we have ETOPS, extended twin operations. And the general aviation, I have EBOPs, extended bladder operations. especially when I'm flying with the family, that I will look at airports about every hour along the way to make sure that's a good place to go in case someone needs to go. And then being a pilot really does help the dispatch side of things, I think, because you have the experience of being a pilot in command. You could put yourself in the same role. Yes, do I have an Airbus typewriting? No, but it's an airplane. And if I was the pilot command of that airplane, what would I do? And you could see why the pilots make those decisions. And you could see sometimes like why did you guys make that decision opposed to trust me, I'd do the same thing that they are doing.
So
with air traffic controllers, oftentimes it's said that if you're good at solving puzzles, that you become you have a tendency to be a good air traffic controller. Is there a skill set that you could say that all dispatchers have that makes them a great dispatcher?
I'd say it's pretty much the same thing. It's multitasking. You have to multitask. We don't work one flight at a time. It we'll have 10 to 15 airplanes on our roster up at a time. We'll have the Thanks, Captain Rick Bell.
Rick just did the ear thing again.
We'll have 10 to 15 airplanes that are like, they're not all going to the same airport. They're not from the same airport. You have to manage information. We have a constant flow of information that is coming through us, and we have to decipher it. A lot of it's junk, but if it's something that's valid, we have to pull the valid part out of the junk and then send it on to the crew, and you need to know where they are.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would have thought the dispatchers would have worked, let's say, all the flights for that day out of Washington Dulles, but you're saying you could do Washington, Chicago, Denver, all in the same shift.
The way ACME runs it is by region. So we'll have a region small enough that, like, does Atlanta to the Carolinas, in like North Carolina, Virginia. I call it like the Tobacco Road desk, because that's pretty much what it is. You do Richmond, Dulles, Greensville, Spartanburg, and one more, and like that's it. You have four airports in Atlanta, and you run all of those flights between those four airports. Your world is literally three states. That's all you care about is the weather in your three states. And then you open it up, you have desks that run Transcon. There's one guy that just runs our Kennedy, San Francisco, San Francisco's back to Kennedy. That's all they do. They only care about those two airports and what's going on, but their world is now the continental United States. We have a Paris desk, an Amsterdam desk, a London desk that work all of the flights from the continental United States to that airport and then back. So it's really region-based. So it's not really like, oh, here's a new flight, let's work this one. So you work a region. So that's how it's broken up.
Well, fascinating. It's it's been a long day, and we still have more to go. Mike, I guess you need to move on to do some other things.
Yeah, I get to go back outside. The perk of bringing the airplane is here. You get to stand outside by the airplane with the door open, and you get to let little kids come in, or big kids, or middle-aged women come in and take a look and sit in the airplane and really show. It's like you guys say, you try to spark that passion for aviation, and I hope that's what we're doing. With the in-laws here, I had my nephew got to come, and my sister-in-law brought her stepdaughter, and I got to sit inside with them, and that's, last night I gave her a 20. I'm like, here you go, here's parking. I'm not doing this because you can't afford it. I'm doing this because this is what I do with my nieces and my nephews. I pay for them to come to aviation things because I want them to get the bug. This is a great industry. It's been very well for me. There's more to do in our industry than be a pilot. You can do anything, and we're desperately needing to try to get people into our industry.
And this is a great event for helping do that. So thanks for coming. I'm glad you brought your plane. I haven't been outside yet still. So
Have you ever gone outside yet? I mean, I've listened to this podcast for a few years now, and I believe it's every year you say, I really need to try to get outside next year.
And every year we try to push him outside and he won't go.
Yeah, have you listened to the shows where Max isn't on? He doesn't want to leave us alone with the controls.
No. I did that once. You guys did a really good job, actually. I was kind of surprised. Anyway, thanks. Thanks, Mike, for joining us.
All right, no problem. Thank you, guys.
You know, it's really been kind of gratifying. We've met a lot of our listeners today. Folks have walked by and said, oh, airplane geeks, I've been listening for a couple of years or whatever, and we've had some great conversations. But we have Andrew with us. Andrew, you've been listening for
probably about 3 years now.
And we haven't chased him away yet.
Yeah, not
That's
yet.
That's right. There's always time. There's always time. So, Andrew, what's your interest in aviation?
My interest really started when I was about seven. I went on one of those Young Eagle flights,
and really just got bit by the bug. And I've been pretty much obsessed since then. You know, all I do is think about airplanes. Every time I hear one fly over, I'm
always
looking up.
You're one of those guys that looks up at the sky,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how did you find out about the podcast?
To be honest, I don't remember.
Most people don't, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, now that I've found it, it's definitely on my, you know, weekly list of podcasts, and it's one of my favorites to listen to. I love it.
So, in terms of your career, in aviation, not in aviation?
Yeah, so I just graduated from Penn State with a degree in supply chain management, and at the end of this month, June, I'll be starting for Textron Aviation in Wichita, and couldn't be more excited to get out there and start my career in aviation. Unfortunately, not as a pilot yet. My goal is to, you know, that's what I want to do eventually is fly. So starting near airplanes and getting to be around them every day is a dream.
Yeah, so there's a club that you'll be able to join, right?
Yeah, the Employee Flying Club is certainly one of the main draws for me to, you know, to accept that that role, getting to fly the planes that come right off the line. You know, I can't wait to do that. It's going to be awesome.
Now, we have a lot of young listeners, as you know, and Textron Aviation is a corporate giant, but consists of many names that others might know of, but not knowing what Textron is. Could you tell us who Textron includes?
Textron is the parent company, includes a bunch of different industries. For example, last summer I worked for Textron Specialized Vehicles in Augusta, Georgia. They build golf carts and lawn mowers and things like that. Textron Aviation is Cessna and Beechcraft now. So, you know, building both of those in the three or two separate factories in Wichita.
And so Wichita, of course, is the capital of aviation.
It's a hub, yeah.
A hub, yes. There's a lot of aviation that goes on in Wichita. So, yeah if you really want to immerse yourself in aviation.
It's a place to be for aviation, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So are you going to be doing supply chain work for Textron?
Yeah, I'll be a materials scheduling analyst. So I'll be on the line, basically scheduling when materials get sent to the line, keeping things moving.
This is actually a big area, not just in aviation, but certainly for a lot of aviation companies, because, you know, these companies are always looking to find ways to reduce costs and inventory, reducing inventory is part of it, setting up flows so that the components come together at the right time. It's a difficult challenge.
It is.
As you know. But it's an important part of the you know, the success of a company. Also, it occurs to me that, you know, it gets you right in there with the product. And when you're thinking about it, starting an aviation career and working for an aviation company, I think that if you can get as close to the product as possible, you know, that's going to be an advantage to you through
your
career.
Absolutely. You know, in my interview, one of the questions I asked was, you know, how often do you get to see and touch airplanes? And he said, well, every day. And that was, you know, that was what I was looking for. That was
so
the
that's
exact,
what closed it for you?
Yeah. That was a pretty easy one for me right there.
So you said you've been listening to Airplane Geeks for a couple of years. That's great. We know you're not crazy because you're not one of those people that somehow decides they have to go back to episode one and get caught up with all the ridiculousness of.
But if he does, he could go to airplanegeeks.com/archive and download all of them by year.
Mm. If you're crazy. That's good. So because you've got some experience, so do you have a favorite host?
I can't pick favorites. I
tell everyone it's Rob Mark.
You know, I can't pick a favorite. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Wait, you're a starving college student, right? It's $20. That'll sway your vote.
Yeah. Under the table? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. But in terms of the podcast, of Airplane Geeks, what are sort of some of the aspects of it that you find most attractive? What do you like best?
The guests are all so different. You get a different aspect of aviation in every guest and every week. And in terms of, you know, expanding your knowledge of aviation in general, just being, you get to expose to so many different people and their careers, which is very exciting and interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of a hallmark of the show. At least we try to. You know, if you spend some time with the podcast consultant, there actually are podcast consultants. It's actually becoming a pretty big business. You talk to them, you know, they will always say, focus, you know, very niche. You know, the more you can focus, the more successful your show will be. And, I mean, you could say we're focused on aviation, except that's not much of a focus, right?
Yeah, we're very focused specifically on aviation.
Aviation. Right. But we kind of buck the trend, I think, or the advice, let's say, in terms of focus. But that's intentional because, you know, like you say, we want to look at the variety and the differences and, you know, find the aspects of aviation that, you know, maybe we're not otherwise exposed to and bring that. And a lot of that comes from the guests, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Max T has really narrowed it down and does a really great job with his show, and it works great for him. But, you know, for the airplane geeks, having, you know, aviation being as, you know, narrow as the topic is, works perfectly.
Yeah. And you know, Captain Jeff from the Airline Pilot Guy show is here. And there's certainly, you know, a number of other aviation podcasts. And as we've talked to Micah, they're all different. They all offer something kind of unique.
And what's really fortunate about it, being different, being unique, we become kind of an aviation podcast family by happenstance, because there's no rivalry between Captain Jeff's APG and the Airplane Geeks, although we're better, and Plane Talking UK, which is another great show. And, you know, there's no rivalry among the three of us, although we're the best. And they're all listening, and they know that I'm saying that. But we really are all very, very good friends and really family. And that's what's wonderful about having a podcast, because when we meet people like you, you're a part of the family now.
Yeah. It feels good.
That's true, of course. But then, to be perfectly honest, Micah sort of hedges his bets on that, because he somehow shows up on all of those podcasts.
But he loves us the most.
but I love you the most. As I've been called on the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, I'm just a podcast whore.
Okay. All right. Well, Andrew, did you have a great time today? What did you? What are your thoughts about the event today?
Well, you know, another positive airline story of the week. United bringing out the 777 is really awesome. You know, this is the best museum in the world, in my opinion. And you know, all the countless hours that I've spent here over the years, this is probably one of the best days that I've had here. So yeah, it's awesome.
That's great. And you'll be moving to Wichita, so you'll be kind of far away from the museum.
I will.
You probably won't see you next year.
Yeah, but, you know, I think when I'm coming home on those trips home, I might have to make a stop here.
Perfect.
It might just have to be one of the places I come to.
Perfect. Andrew, thanks for talking with us. Oh, go ahead.
Although I may appear on all the other podcasts with the Airplane Geeks, I'm the contributor at large, and this is where I'm home.
That's right, our main man. Thank you, Michael. All right, Andrew, thanks again. Appreciate you listening to Airplane Geeks, and glad you had a great time here today. I think lots of folks did today. I don't know what the turnout is like compared to the past. It's kind of hard to tell because this place is so big, so it's sort of hard to get a crowd size view, but it seems like it's been a very successful day.
Yeah, it's certainly been crowded all day long.
Yeah. Hey, Andrew, thank you.
All right, thanks, guys.
Well, now we have a guest who is not unique to the Airplane Geeks, because he's been a guest before many, many years ago, but we all know him and we all love him. It's Captain Jeff from the Airline Pilot Guy. Welcome back to the Airplane Geeks and to the Udvar-Hazy Center.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back on the premier podcast in the aviation world.
Yours?
No, yours, of course. You guys,
welcome to the Mutual Flattery Association, folks.
We all really do love each other in so many different ways. And Jeff, you know, we know you as the podcaster, the creator of the Airline Pilot Guy. We know you as a captain of a major airline flying MD-80s. We know you as a former Air Force officer flying a C-141. But another part of your Air Force career, and this is what I wanted to ask you about today, and obviously, Max, you can edit this out any way you need to. You were also a flight instructor for quite some time in the Air Force. And if I remember correctly, and you're going to need to correct me if I have this wrong, as a flight instructor, you worked with a lot of pilots that were having difficulty and were able to bring them back and be able to really help them become the pilots. Can you tell us about how you became an instructor and how you ended up with that kind of task? Because it's really very unique among instructors, I would think.
Well, in the Air Force, the instructor pilot cadre possess certain skills. When you go through regular pilot training, you're being assessed consistently and constantly and consistently. And by the time you graduate, you have been evaluated so much, and the instructors in that latter advanced stage of pilot training start talking with each other and deciding, okay, this group of guys, at the time we didn't have any females in our class, so this group of guys have skills to fly more advanced type airplanes, fighters, reconnaissance, attack, and it's called fighter, attack, reconnaissance, qualified, FAR qualified, we called it. And then amongst this group, there's a subset of this group that have the skills to be able to teach others. So not only do they have the skills to fly high-performance airplanes, complicated airplanes, but they also have the skills, the people skills, to kind of lend instruction to people learning how to fly. And then we call that IP qualified. So if you're FAR IP qualified, you're in this very, you know, small group of people. And a lot of these people, after they graduate from pilot training, come back to be instructor pilots. And we call them first assignment instructor pilots. I was told toward the very end of my pilot training that I was kind of in that group. And I just assumed that I was going to come back right away as an instructor pilot. And I kind of consigned myself to that, or resigned myself, probably the better word to use. Not consigned. Yeah, Air Force consigns. I was resigned. And I was a little disappointed, to be honest with you, because I'd always kind of hoped to fly big airplanes and be in the airline world eventually after my military career. And so it wasn't until the very end that I learned that my consistency in pilot training got me into a group of people that could choose what they wanted and could avoid coming back if they didn't want to come back as an instructor pilot. So my consistency got, I don't know how, but got me up in that top group. We call distinguished graduates. So I was able to pick the airplane I wanted to fly, and I was very happy because I wanted to fly the C-141. Went off and did that because I wanted to fly big airplanes, crew airplanes. I thought that might be the kind of environment that would really help me maybe after the military fly for the airlines. And not realizing at the time that it really doesn't matter, that the airlines really look at the person as a whole and not so much what kind of experience they had in the military, but whether they were instructor pilots and whatever airplane they were flying, evaluators, that kind of thing. So the story goes on. I go off to fly the 141, get trained in that, fly it for a couple of years, and got this notification that the Air Training Command of the Air Force was interested in me coming back to their command to instruct. I went, no, I want to fly my C-141 for my time in the Air Force. And but again, I was resigned to the fact that I was going to be coming back as an instructor pilot. And I'm so glad that I did, actually, because it's such a rewarding thing to instruct people, basically mold these people who have maybe zero to very little experience in flying, and to bring them in and instruct them, teach them how to fly a jet and acrobatics and formation flying and navigation instruments, whatever.
Yeah, but isn't it kind of nerve-wracking having them try to kill you every once in a while?
Well, funny you should mention that. I used to have dark brown hair. Now, if you could see a picture of me, you'd see that I don't have dark brown hair anymore. It's, silver, white, whatever. All the pigmentation's gone. Yeah, it was quite a stressful thing. Anyway, the so going back to what Micah said, so because I come back from a weapon systems airplane, I already have experience flying. I'm not a first assignment instructor pilot. I've been doing this for a couple of years. I come back, the natural position that they put you in a flight is the assistant flight commander. And the assistant flight commander is second in charge to the flight commander. And the assistant flight commander, one of the special things that you get to do is end up flying with students in your class that you're teaching at the time that may be having some trouble with various things. And it was my responsibility to fly with these people and to see if I could get them fixed so that they could move on, get over whatever it was they were experiencing, and go on to the advanced portion of pilot training.
Just to clarify, and without wanting to insult anybody that you might have trained who's still flying or was flying, you said having some trouble with them, some things. Does that mean, in non-technical jargon, people about ready to wash out?
Yes. They were, and I forgot what we called the various classifications, and they were being exposed to a process where they had like a certain number of flights remaining that they had a chance to either proceed or get washed out. And it's always hard to see that, especially because most of these people are really nice people and they really are motivated to do this. And what I found out was that a lot of these... Did I mention that we were consistently and constantly evaluated in pilot training? Well, it's a very high-stress environment, and people respond to stress differently. Some can handle it, and some have trouble with it. Combine that with the fact that a lot of these people are flying with first assignment instructor pilots who aren't the smoothest. I'm not going to say that they're all not smooth, but they don't have the experience of flying fighters in the real world or transports or bombers or whatever, and have some flying experience under their belt. And they sometimes are mistakenly equate being aggressive with being jerky and not smooth. See where I'm going here? So a lot of these folks that were getting close to elimination were having trouble. They're getting airsick most of the time. 90% of the people that were getting close to washed out couldn't keep it down. And what I found was it wasn't just the environment of high G's and, you know, the flying environment necessarily. It was a combination of the very high stress. They were expected to perform at a certain high level, and the fact that they were with a new instructor pilot who equated aggressiveness with really being jerky with the way the airplane's flown. And those things put together sometimes resulted in them getting sick. So what I would do is I would have a very laid-back environment. I would say, this is what we're going to go out and do, and this is how we're going to do it. And I tried to be as laid-back and as calm and comforting as I could. And when I flew the airplane, I flew it very, very smoothly. So that component of the air sickness a lot of times was gone, and my more laid-back approach to what I expected from them helped them to have more confidence in doing it. And my track record was that every single one of the students that were just about to get washed out made it through to the next level of their advanced level of training, the T-38. So I was instructing in the T-37 at the time, which is now retired. Just add it to the whole list of airplanes that I've flown in my life that have either been retired or are in the process of being retired, like the one I'm flying now. But anyway, the T-37 was the basic jet trainer. And then if you made it through that aspect of the training, then you would go to the advanced flight training and fly that airplane that the NASA guy, was talking to us about.
The T-38?
The T-38, yeah. So, and I'm not sure. I never kept track of all the folks that I helped move on to the next level of training, if they made it through the whole process. But I'm relatively sure that they all did. So,
now, I'm curious, and you may not know this, but you know the Air Force military keeps records and data and percentages and statistics on everything. Being that that was an assignment that you got based on your command level at the time, how was your record in terms of moving people along compared to others in a similar position? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. No idea. I was just happy that I had the opportunity to help people, you know, continue to pursue their dreams of flying a military airplane.
And do you think your experience as an instructor and teaching others to fly affects your piloting now?
You know, I've never thought of that. I guess it does.
Yeah, what about the bit of just being a captain and having a first officer and helping the first officer gain the skills to become a captain? Does that fit in at all?
Yeah, I suppose so. A lot of time, you know, a lot of my career has been spent flying with first officers that are very experienced in the airplane that I'm flying at the time. And so, in fact, in some cases, some of the first officers I've flown with had been on the airplane that I'm flying longer than I have. So not a lot of instructing advice given to those kind of pilots. But lately, in the major airline world, we've been hiring a lot of people that are new to this major airline world. And because they're new, they still have a lot of experience flying for the regionals or the military, but they don't have the experience flying in the major airlines. And I feel like I have more, not an opportunity, but I'm more comfortable with maybe giving, not instruction, but maybe some advice, some tips, that kind of thing. So I guess maybe my experience as an instructor pilot in the military helps with that, I suppose.
And with a Mad Dog, I guess, soon to be retired, are these new pilots coming in flying the MD-80, 90, or are they being assigned to other aircraft first?
It shifts around. A lot of them, that is the first assignment that they're getting, although that is kind of shifting around a little bit now because the fleet is being retired. And so now it just depends on the crew resources and where that body is needed for, you know, whether it be the 767ER category, where, you know, we need people because they have two first officers, you have a relief first officer. And so if the need is for more pilots to be in that category, that's where they go to begin with. If they need more pilots in the 717 or MD-88, MD-90 category, that's where they go. It really depends on what crew resources determines is where the greatest need is. But for the most part, they end up in the cockpit of the Mad Dog. Yeah. So that'll change, of course. You know, it used to be when I got hired, the entry position was a flight. It wasn't even a pilot position, actually. It was a flight engineer position. You weren't at the controls of an airplane. And for most of us in my vintage, you started sitting sideways, we said, or plumbing, a couple of different terms we used for being a flight engineer. But you would eventually make your way up to the right seat in the 727 or maybe the DC-9 and then go on with your career. There were some airlines at the time that had professional engineers. The airline that I fly for did not. And so the entry position was actually not a flying position. But again, you normally didn't stay in that position for very long before you moved on to a job where you actually were at the controls of an airplane.
And by professional engineer, you mean non-pilot, whereas your airline required the engineer to be a pilot.
Yes. Yeah. There are some airlines like Pan Am. I'm not sure about TWA, but the flight engineers were professional flight engineers, and that was the extent to which they would progress in the cockpit. and I could move from maybe from the flight engineer position in a 727 to flight engineer position in an L-1011, and that would be a, you know, higher pay rate and that kind of thing, but they would never go from there to first officer or captain. Now, a lot of these first officers, I mean, these professional engineers were private pilots, and, you know, you can't really say that they weren't pilots, but they weren't providing that. They weren't employed by the airline to do a piloting job.
So besides airplanes that no longer exist, you have positions in airplanes that no longer exist in your career.
Yeah, I guess you're gathering that I'm kind of been around for a while. I'm kind of old.
No, I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't say that.
We're taking pictures of his silver hair, folks, so you could all see the silver fox of podcasting.
So, Captain Jeff mentioned the people want to get in touch with you. I think it's time to plug away.
Well, the Airline Pilot Guy Show, we have a couple of ways to send feedback. Feedback at airlinepilotguy.com is a great way. Go to the website, airlinepilotguy.com, or how else could we do that? That's pretty much covered it.
Thank you so much for being a guest on another podcast.
Yeah, and Captain Jeff, thank you so much. I guess a few years ago when you started Catholic Pilot, that's when I first started listening to the show, and you've just done a great job with the podcast, and really appreciate all the hours and hours and hours that you've spent doing it, and all the information that you've provided throughout the years as well. It's been great fun listening to your show.
Well, thank you very much. Here. It's my pleasure. Labor of love.
All right, well, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening to the wide variety of folks we talked to this year. Micah, we really got a lot of variety in terms of who we talked to.
You know, this is, what, my third time here in 4 years, and I think that we may have had more interview time and more different people to interview this time than we ever had before.
It feels that way. We'll see how it comes out at the end.
And you know, it could be that you may have to, who knows, and you may have to record a second close for a second show, because I think you got a lot of content there.
Well, either that or we may have to make it as long as an episode of Airline Pilot Guy.
The 3-hour extravaganza.
Oh, I hope not. Any reflections, David, on the event today?
This is probably one of the best, as far as outside exhibits, probably one of the best ones we've had in a long time. As far as diversity, from general aviation to civil aviation to military aviation, there's a little bit of everything outside, which is, sometimes it's one more leading the other, but... And there was also a Stanley steamer. So that's always a good thing. Oh, yes, folks, that is a car.
Yeah, there are a bunch of classic cars out there.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know because, again, I never made it outside, which is...
And for all of those who are concerned that Max never gets out, it's not like we don't offer for him to do so.
I know. Well, I'm at the mic usually, it seems. But Brian, what did you think about today?
It went by really, really fast. As usual, it was great seeing our listeners, fellow podcasters, aviation enthusiasts, but these few hours here have just flown by.
They really did. And in fact, we kind of missed a few folks that we wanted to speak with. We didn't get a chance to talk with Jennifer, at least not yet. Hillel, who flew in, we didn't talk to him.
Dinner? Maybe we could interview him at dinner.
Ah, perhaps, because that's coming up next. Micah, what did you think about the day?
I think it was just a marvelous day. Got to visit with you guys, and there's nothing better than that. And what I really need to do, the most important thing from my perspective to do right now, is I need to thank Mr. David Vanderhoof for his connections and setting things up and putting things together and making this happen, because if it weren't for David, we would never be here at all. And I thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you. It's good. It's good to be here. I got to see all the gang. Though I have to admit that one of our guests didn't show up, so I'm going to have to work on that. But this is always a fun day. It's always a good day to be with friends and airplanes and talk shop and enjoy the rarefied air of the Udvar-Hazy Center.
Yes, yes. And, you know, one of the comments I heard from several of our listeners who are here today is that they brought their family or their relatives or others along with them, people who probably wouldn't have come to this museum otherwise. And it was an opportunity for them to see, you know, what's offered by an aviation museum like this one. So, you know, expanding the base, that's always good.
Yeah, and I think it was really great. Talking with Dispatcher Mike outside at the static display, he was just so excited about the quantity of kids that came by and got to go inside of his aircraft and crawl around and just be exposed to that part of aviation. I think it was really great to have them out there and doing their part as well.
And we saw a lot of that quality, too. I was so impressed with our Civil Air Patrol cadets who were here with us, and we got a chance to interview. What it makes me feel good about, the you know, as an old guy, as the up-and-coming youngsters that are here, because what an incredible couple of kids.
Oh, yes. You know, when I think back to when I was that age, you know, a youngster in high school, I think they were sophomores.
Sophomores.
Boy, there was no way I was anywhere close to being that articulate. Of course, I probably still am not, but being that articulate and self-confident. And, I mean, this is an example, I think, of some women who are going to go on and do some great things. So the CAP really, really does produce some fantastic results, I think. We want to thank you for listening to episode 508 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, then that, of course, is airplanegeeks.com/508. David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
You can find me online at DM Vanderhoof. And if you look up What Just Flew By on Instagram, you'll probably see a lot of the photographs I've taken from the event today. I'll be posting up over the next couple of days. And, of course, on Fridays with that other podcast, the Airplane Geeks podcast. I mean, I'm sorry, the UAV Digest with Max Flight.
All right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, they can reach me tomorrow at the Club by United as I'll be flying from Dulles to Los Angeles International Airport electronically. The best way to get hold of me is send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com, because no one's bothered to show me how to use Slack yet.
That's right. We were supposed to do that today. We didn't get around to that. All right. Micah.
Well, you can find me on Slack, which is a great team to be a member of. And to do that, how do they do that, Max? They send an email to airplanegeeks.com?
That's right. You can request that. If you want to learn a little bit more about what it is, just visit airplanegeeks.com/team.
So I'm available on Slack. I'm available on Twitter at MainFly. That's M-A-I-N-E, like the state, MainFly. And you can always reach me at Micah@airplanegeeks.com.
And thanks for driving all the way down here, Micah. It was good to see you.
Great to see you guys, too.
And I'm Max Flight. Find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Also at the UAVDigest.com, as David says. And also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. We want to thank Bruno Massone for our outro music. And as always, please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
So long.
Thank you to the Smithsonian staff for their hospitality. And thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
I think everyone needs to say the message into the microphone.
Yep.
So you can see what the instructions are. So like when I go in and tell him the instructions, we can see, you can see how the instructions change all the way down.
Okay, very good idea.
It'll be fun.
Okay.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. This is Dispatcher Mike from the Flying Life Podcast. Amazing day here at the Uberhazy Center. Amazing day here. Now afterwards, after we're sunbeaten and all of that, it got pretty hot out there this afternoon, but what an amazing meetup. A lot of aviation geeks here, av geeks here. I'm really thankful for Max and Brian and the other Max for all the work that they do on the show every week. It is every Wednesday is a highlight when the Airplane Geeks podcast gets into my podcatcher. So I'm going to pass it on, and I'm told I need to pass on instructions. So you need to hold about here, say who you are, and then you need to go ahead and you know, say whatever you want, and then you need to pass it on and pass on the instructions.
Hi, I'm Brian, a big fan of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I've probably been listening to it for the last 3 or 4 years. It's so nice to meet everybody in person now.
I'm Rick. I am the brother of the main man, Micah. I'm along here with my niece.
I'm your daughter.
That's right, you are.
I'm Hannah. I'm main man Micah's niece, and apparently a Airplane Geek celebrity. So nice to meet you all.
I'm going to pass on, and here you go.
What are the instructions? Oh, he didn't know.
I have to advise you of the instructions. The instructions are to hold approximately 8 inches from your face and speak normally. Have a great.
Hi there, Captain Jeff here. I do a little podcast, but I'm here mainly just to be Mike Carroll's co-pilot, and he's the host of the Flying and Life podcast, and here to just support the Airplane Geeks. One so far. It was the Lagunitas. And here to support the Airplane Geeks in their 10th year of podcasting or 500 millionth episode. I forgot what it was. But anyway, it's been a great weekend so far. It's Saturday. We're here at the Red Robin enjoying a bunch of great camaraderie. And my instruction, of course, have you already taken your turn? Okay. So I'm going to pass it on to Jacob. And he's going to... So, Jacob, I'm going to pass this on to you. You hold this device right about here, not too close. And you say your name and, you know, why you're here and all that kind of stuff. And also, make sure you tell them what your favorite color is. And then after you do that, you pass it on to your dad and give him the same instructions. Okay, so your name, why you're here, whatever you want to say, and what your favorite color is.
Hello, my name is Jacob. I came here with my dad on a Cherokee. This is our third year flying on a plane, and I don't remember how many times I've been here before, but I've been here lots of times. I don't fly yet, but I hope I will one day. And my favorite color is purple. So he wants you to hold it like right around here. Say your name, whatever, then why you're here, / whatever you want, and then your favorite color. And pass it on. So you hold it right around here. Say your name.
Is there like a start or a stop, or is it just recording?
No, it's just recording.
Okay.
So say your name, why you're here, / whatever else you want to say, and then favorite color.
Favorite color?
He asked me for something very important.
Name, why you're here, favorite color.
Yep. And hold it up to your mouth. No, not there. Like right here.
Here.
All right.
Okay, it's Jennifer here, and I'm here because it's Uberhazy. Why wouldn't I be here? It's awesome. I loved it. I had a great time. My favorite color is chrome, and here is David.
it's David. My favorite color is RLM Gray 76 that was on the Fock Wolf that we were sitting in front of tonight. And why am I here? I'm the one that started all of this, so that's why I'm here.
Say hi, Scott.
This is Scott Cook. My favorite color is blue, and I'm here because Rick Bell brought me here, and I'm happy that he did. It's been fun.
Micah did it.
No, you gotta follow the instructions.
Wait a minute, it's wrong. I know, that's what I said. You hit the.
Hey, that looks like something off the set of Star Trek. What the heck is it?
Dragon.
What are we doing?
Who had it
before you? What were the instructions?
Tell it your name, your favorite color, and why you're here.
Breathe into it and tell you how drunk
and
you are.
And then breathe into it and it'll tell you how drunk you are.
Sandwich for you, sir?
Let me try that again. Hi, it's your main man, Micah, and if I'm supposed to say my favorite color, I think that either khaki or gray matches my personality. And I'm here because it's the Airplane Geeks, and I am the contributor at large, and also a large contributor, and I'm sitting next to a good friend and our favorite NASA historian, Bill Barry.
Oh, so you already gave my name. All right, so Bill Barry, my favorite color is Air Force Blue, and I'm here because all my friends are here.
Yay!
So who's next? Brian's being a, not going to talk to us. Okay, so we're going to bypass Brian and give it to...
My name is Peter Max Jr. My favorite color is white. And I'm here because this is the best crew on the planet. And the device I'm speaking into kind of looks like a taser or a tricorder. God bless.
John.
No, you. What's your name?
Okay. My name is Maiju. And
your favorite color?
My favorite color, red.
Red.
Uh-huh.
And why are you here?
I'm here because I spend time with family here.
Okay. John, you're
John,
up.
Your turn.
My name is John Pham. Favorite color is pink. And I'm here because... I was kidnapped.
Because they made it? What did he say? Is this on?
Yes.
Hi, this is Drone Mama, the long-suffering wife of Max Flight, and I'm here for, I think it's our 10th year at Innovations in Flight at Udvar-Hazy Air and Space. And we had a great day. The guys got lots of interviews, and hope everyone had a great time.
All right, this is Max. I have no idea what just happened or what you listened to. We're all at the Red Robin after the event of the day, the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum Innovation in Flight and Family, Fly-In and Family Display. No, Family, let's see, how does that go? Well, anyway, we had a great day. All I did was... put the recorder at the end of this long line, this long row of folks who are here enjoying some drinks and dinner. Gave them some instructions, told them to pass it along and tell the next person in line what the instructions were. And I think the instructions changed dramatically, but we'll have to listen. So we had a great day. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast, and I guess I'll have to listen to this myself and find out just exactly what happened and what people said.
Brian's got one last question.
Brian's got one last question. Brian dropped a recorder. So if you can't hear me because he broke it when he dropped it, then blame Brian. But here he is.
So this is Brian Coleman. My favorite color is blue. The password to all of my accounts is Alabama27. Wait, what was the other? Oh, breathe into this. How drunk am I? Not enough yet. What was the other question? Oh, none of those. so this was definitely a game of telephone. Well done. I'm here for the friends, camaraderie, and all the fun that we have along the way.
All right, that's it.